This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Gary Nolan, I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today on the Progressive Commentary Hour, we're going to explore in depth conversations on the failure of our government and what third parties can do to bring necessary progressive change. We do not subscribe to any political ideology, and we believe that people's religious views and beliefs are their own and should remain in the sanctity of one's own personal consciousness. I have no right to tell people what to think or do or act when it comes to their body politic, their sexual politic, or their religious beliefs. Instead, taking an independent and progressive point of view, and in this term so you understand what progressive means, because we have, according to the latest ratings, hundreds of thousands of new listeners coming on a regular basis monthly. All of us at one time belonged to different belief systems. We grew up valuing input from our elders and the teachers and family and those that we respected. And one day we have an opportunity to see if those beliefs work for us or against us, in part or whole, cumulative in the positive or cumulative in the negative. And that is how we end up where we are today. A country that is out of control, a body politic that people fear. People using the power of their agencies and the confidence that they have obtained from the public vote to mandate what they believe should be our rights, shredding the Constitution, eviscerating the Bill of Rights, neglecting the real hard values that America was established on, all so that their own unique and exclusive corporate mindset can maintain its supremacy. Now, we have this supercilious notion that there's 99% and 1%. That may be unique and all right as a overall understanding, but it's not true. I believe that the reason that we have 1% is because 99% have given away the power of their choices. And in the process of doing that, they have abrogated much of the responsibility to what they should eat and how much and what they should do as far as understanding what the rights of states and governments and federal governments and their right in the process is, and how to hold people accountable that you've given your power to. And hence we have people with massive power who virtually have a world to themselves. If you and I commit a crime, we are held accountable. If they commit a crime, they are not, certainly not by the same standards. And if a corporation commits a crime, no matter how egregious, no matter how many people die, they are not held accountable at all, except maybe financially, and that is merely the cost of doing business. Our interest is in being able to find positive solutions that benefit all of us within our society, and wherever the truth of that choice comes from, that's what it is. Hence, in a progressive agenda, there is no political moniker, there is merely seeking positive solutions. That's all we care about. So everyone's invited to the table. A Green, a Constitutionalist, a Peace Party, a Libertarian, all are invited. If you are a nun or an atheist, you're both invited. If you're an academic or completely uneducated, you're both invited. I do not believe in the politics of exclusion. And hence we begin our discussion. That is merely an overview because so many people are coming onto this program. This is, by the way, the most downloaded radio program in the United States in commercial or non-commercial radio. And we thank you for sharing this program with others. We have a large panel today, and in the order that I'll share, we will introduce them. First up, we're going to be speaking with Judge James Jim Gray, and he will be here on behalf of a major party, and it's a growing party, and it's the Libertarian Party. He is here because of former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson is unable to attend, but his vice presidential running mate, and virtually this is a case where either one of them could be interchangeable, in my opinion, in qualifications and in capacity. We will hear from him first. Then we will speak with Rocky Anderson. Rocky is both a very charismatic and highly respected person who is the presidential candidate for the new National Justice Party, which he was instrumental in founding. He is a former two-term mayor of Salt Lake City, having served from 2000-2008 as the executive director for the organization High Road for Human Rights. And prior to entering politics, he practiced law in Utah for 21 years and was listed among the best lawyers in America. And Businessweek listed him as one of the top 20 activists on climate change, and he has received many awards for that. He is a former member of the Democratic Party. He left over his evisceration of the Constitution and it having morphed into a poor alternative to the GOP. Judge Jim Gray is currently was presiding over the civil trial calendar for the Superior Court of Orange County, where he served since 1989. He has devoted many years in social reform and civic philanthropy, especially in the areas of education, alcohol and drug programs, and supporting centers for the treatment of psychological and physical trauma. He also served in the Peace Corps and was a defense attorney in the Navy JAG Corps during the Vietnam era. He ran as a Republican candidate for the U.S. Congress in 1998 and in 2004 ran for the U.S. Senate for the Libertarian Party. He is the author of two books, Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and Wearing the Robe, Art and Responsibilities of Judging in Today's Courts. And we will go to those two first. Then that will be followed with Professor Harvey Wasserman. He is professor of history at Columbus State College and Capital University in Ohio. He is an investigative journalist, and he has been a national voice in the anti-war and anti-nuclear movements for four decades. In fact, I would dare say that if it were not for Harvey Wasserman and Carl Grossman, both professors, we would not have had the advances in closing down some of our dangerous nuclear plants, but they were responsible for leading for two of those plants closing. He is also a senior advisor for Greenpeace and Nuclear Information Resource Services. Among his books are George Bush versus Superpower of Peace. And we will finalize our program today with Dr. Jill Stein. She is a medical physician, board certified in internal medicine, and a pioneer in advocating environmental health issues in Massachusetts, and she is the current presidential candidate for the Green Party. She's a magna cum laude from Harvard. She received also a doctorate from Harvard Medical School. She's an MD, PhD. And over the years, Dr. Stein has been active in campaigns to better protect women and children from toxic pollution that's contributing to learning disabilities and fighting the coal industry and the burning of waste. She is on the National Board of Directors of the organization Physicians for Social Responsibility, and she's won awards for her efforts to help clean up water and help children's health. And she ran for state as a state representative in 2004 and again ran for Secretary of State in 2006. Her website is jillstein.org. I will also be sharing at the beginning of our program a commentary from a person who was on last week, and because he was on last week, we felt that a short commentary would suffice, and that will be Professor Peter Phillips. Professor Phillips is a professor of political sociology and social movements at Sonoma State University. He is the president of Media Freedom Foundation and Project Censored, and he also hosts a program weekly on the Progressive Radio Network. His short commentary is called Desperate Times Demand Revolutionary Measures. We will begin with his in a moment. So that's our lineup. A lot of people have not heard this program. Let me explain how I do this, and then we'll go to our guests. I believe that we should have very comprehensive introduction to a topic. If it takes 2 minutes or it takes 10 minutes, that is not the primary issue. The primary issue is, do we have enough knowledge of what we're trying to achieve? Are we on point? And then allow our guest, unhindered, unencumbered by interruption, to use it as a classroom on the air, to truly give us an education, unrushed, no short soundbite information. So if it takes them 10 minutes or 30 minutes to answer a question, they will have that opportunity as long as they're on point. That is the way we do it. In fact, we give more opportunity, more time for the individuals, and this is true of my entire radio career, to answer questions, because I believe we should use it as a classroom on the air. It's that simple. So at least at the end of this program, whether you agree or disagree with any particular point of view that anyone has answered, at least you understand the context in which they're giving you an answer. So for some people who are used to little quick chit-chats, five-minute shows, five-minute interviews, seven-minute interview, which is long, or the longest of them all, 60 minutes, which is about 13 minutes, this is an altogether different ballgame. As such, we may go 2 to 3, even 4 hours in our discussion, and that's why I've set aside this program for the evening, so that we are not encumbered by any time restraints. Let us begin. First, a commentary, short but important, from Professor Peter Phillips. Don't waste any more time or energy on the presidential election than it takes to get to your polling station and pull a lever for a third-party candidate. Just enough to register your obstruction and defiance, and then get back out on the street. That is where the question of real power is being decided. That was from Chris Hedges on our program about a month ago. Runaway capitalism is moving unrelentingly towards social, political, environmental collapse, cheered on by a two-headed single-party machine known as the U.S. Congress. Activists who see the coming disasters as catastrophic are seeking revolutionary change through non-cooperation and Occupy disruptions. Yet many are still delusional hopefuls, desperately fumbling with traditional responses. The futile support of progressive left-leaning candidates seeking positions of influence inside the Washington Beltway is considered of non-essential media coverage. Do we understand that habeas corpus is no longer a legal protection in the United States, or the U.S. president can torture and kill American citizens, let alone anyone in the world? How can we ignore the inconvenient truths of warrantless wiretaps and electronic monitoring for everyone? Why do we tolerate that U.S.-led NATO forces killing people in over 100 countries in the world using special service operatives, private assassin, and drones? 1 million civilian deaths in Iraq alone. How can we be so blind as not see our corporate media is a propaganda fog machine for the 1%? These questions, reflecting the reality of America today, are so far from the values of our traditions that accepting any aspect of authority from Washington, D.C. is a sacrilege to our honor. We are in desperate times. In Congress, wealth begets membership, and wealth is the reward for correct action. The members in the House and Senate have a collective net worth of $2.4 billion, up from $1.6 billion in 2008. While at the same time, American households' net worth has continued to decline and the number of people living in poverty has risen for the fifth year in a row. The American Congress is in reality an artificial organization serving as cheerleader to the transnational corporate classes of the world. Congress offers its members little more than a transitional path into the good life of corporate affluence as long as the members remain loyal to party discipline. Our legitimate electoral process has been completely usurped by the Supreme Court ruling that a corporation's free speech rights allow unlimited campaign spending and congressional lobbying knows no bounds. Any candidate willing to serve in the Democratic or Republican parties in the United States Congress today, even as a gadfly of resistance, is stepping beyond the pale of constitutional government. Even if a progressive Democrat of America move on into the congressional circle, the magnitude of compromise demanded makes effective action impossible other than occasional symbolic votes of resistance. Those stepping out of party lines will invariably result in orchestrated opposition during the next selection cycle? Just ask Cynthia McKinney. Reform is not an option. The only action possible is a complete and total return to the social justice values of our U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights. We cannot allow extrajudicial killings, privacy invasions into our homes, and police state interceptions in the commons. We cannot allow global capitalism to continue to kill and impoverish billions of people and destroy the planet. Protecting and even rewriting our Constitution and our Bill of Rights will require revolutionary acts. We must retool our elections and eliminate, ignore the dark clouds of corporate media at our risk. A mass movement at this level requires grassroots action by a core of at least 10% of our population. Getting 1 out of 10 people actively involved is not at all impossible. This is where our traditional values meet human rights. We are people of hope that only need to overcome our fears and find the voice of our values by using radical democracy for human betterment for all. In conclusion, the right to vote is a long-held value. We often ask, why waste your vote on an independent third-party candidate that will never have a chance to win? Can voting for a candidate who reflects your own political values and beliefs be a wasted vote? I think not. It seems that voting for your true beliefs is a self-actualizing act, and compromising one's value to pick the lesser of two evils is self-alienating. Therefore, I urge you all to continue to vote, but find candidates outside of the two-party oligarchy. Maybe someday self-actualized voting will be fashionable. End quote, Professor Peter Phillips. Those are his views, but I felt it necessary to share them. Now let's introduce our first panelist, Judge Jim Gray. Nice to have you with us today, sir.
Well, thank you, Gary. It's certainly nice to be with you as well as this really distinguished panel. And may I quickly say, too, I'd like to pass respects on to Rocky Anderson, who has been doing some good things while he was governor, while he was mayor and thereafter. So it's nice to be with you. Thank you.
Good. I might mention to our audience that I will be asking each of you a series of questions. All of you will have the same identical questions, and I will ask you to give us your comments based upon how you look at the current status and how you would change it. Those are the two positions I'm asking. And though I don't limit your answers, I'm asking you to try to keep them as concise as possible so we can get through everyone can get through the same questions. All right?
I understand.
Okay, let us begin. Perhaps the single largest mistake that is repeatedly noted by contributing to the economic recession was the removal of the Glass-Steagall Act. And now we are also witnessing the adverse effects of Clinton's signing of the Commodity Futures Modernization Act just before he left office. What, in your view, have been the negatives of both of these policy decisions, and what would be your remedy?
Well, we have seen a collapse with regard to our financial condition, the government. Basically, honestly, Gary, it's the government that has caused these things, both by taking away some restrictions as well as being asleep at the switch in doing some regulations. I don't think we need more laws, but we have to make sure that our institutions stay within them and that they don't blend together various types of activities that they have no business being in. Just by listening to your opening commentary, we do not have responsibility at all levels of our society. I was a former federal prosecutor in Los Angeles, and I prosecuted actually crimes against the VA and FHA, mostly prosecuted bank vice presidents. We simply must reinstitute holding people accountable in our society at every level. And then, if you look at government, say with the housing crisis, with these various other institutional calamities, it was the government that was insuring the bad loans. So, of course, banks are going to start making bad loans because they take away the risk. And now the government is standing in the way of banks giving reasonable business loans because they have overreacted so much that they're overly regulating the market. So what we need to bring back prosperity to our great country is, number one, reduce government spending. And Governor Johnson's will be presenting a balanced budget to the Congress in 2013, and it would reduce spending by about 43%, because today, for every dollar the federal government is spending, they're borrowing 43 cents. Simply cannot be done. We are becoming Greece, and it's a real desperate crisis that we are in. But secondly, we need to renew prosperity, and Governor Johnson has a plan actually to change our tax system. And this sounds radical until you think about it, until you understand it, and it's not. And that is, you repeal the income tax. You get rid of the IRS. Now, immediately, of course, everybody will have a tax break because you don't have to keep all of these records and prepare all of your tax returns, et cetera, and go to a consumption tax at the end. But that will also encourage spending, because today we punish people for spending, for saving money, that is, because we take part of it. We punish people for investing money because we take part of it. Those restrictions would be gone. And also, for our goods, going exported goods from our country, they're at a disadvantage because they are paying taxes on them before they even leave our shores, competing against other goods in other countries that have not paid that tax. Same thing is true in reverse with the imports that we have. They have not paid taxes, but our domestic goods have. And I've been speaking to people about this, and they say, you know, in fact, even an executive for Nike was telling me that if we were to repeal the income tax, we would very likely have many companies bringing manufacturing back to the United States. So these are things that have been caused by the government. It's the government that has been doing these things. Governor Johnson has a record in New Mexico as the governor for 8 years on positive solutions, certainly with regard to drug policy, with regard to fiscal policy. He actually vetoed 750 excessive spending bills while he was governor, more than every other governor, 49 governors combined, and only two of them were actually vetoed or overturned by the Democratic legislature. So that's what we need to do. We need to spread this around and go forward in a financial responsibility mode, but also to bring back the security of the United States, yes, but also our soul, which is our freedoms and our liberties. And our soul is under attack by the so-called Patriot Act, this NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act that you were mentioning before. This is absolutely intolerable to someone who believes in the land of the free. We will bring these things back by repealing those disastrous measures, bringing back our soul, that is, our freedoms.
Let me take you a little further on this, and this will be true with any of our guests, where I see that you've opened up a door. I want to go through that door with you, and so we get more clarity, all right?
Please.
When I first went to work for WNYC, the official radio station of the city of New York, I was surprised that the engineering studio was something out of the 1930s. In fact, the engineering had dials you turn, like in a Frankenstein movie, where they turn the dials and things, you know, the little electrodes go up and down. And yet, there were 80 people in the office. So I asked the head of the station, the woman who hired me, I said, "Why do you have ancient equipment, and yet you have an office filled with people?" And she said, "That's the way it comes. These are all political jobs." So I went out one day, and I just started talking with the people. They were reading the newspaper. Nobody was working. And at the end of that conversation, I was told that these people didn't have to work. Yet they were on full salaries. They were getting every right. They couldn't be fired. And so that was the day I quit. And when I went in to give my resignation, and I'd only been there 3 days, and from there I went over to WBAI, and people asked, "Why did you leave WNYC, where you were paid the highest amount of money, and went to WBI, where you paid nothing?" I said, "Because I didn't like the idea that the American taxpayer was paying for a group of people to sit in a bureaucracy in the city, wasting the taxpayers' money. It's no different when I watch 25 people doing the work, or one person doing the work and 25 people standing around, and why a private project gets done in 1 month, and a government, the same identical government project, takes 2 years and always an overrun. I'm, like many Americans, fed up. with no one having the courage to go in and take on the unions or the top political people in these state, local, and federal programs and work ourselves down to a government that actually is lean and mean and is there to serve the public interest, not to in any way become the self-serving, ever-expanding bureaucracies on bureaucracies. What is your position on this?
Well, Gary, and good for you and in your own personal experience, and that's exactly what we will be doing when we go to Washington. The first thing that we would have on our, one of the first, is to put in sunset provisions for all federal agencies, such that maybe every 5 years, each one would have to come individually to Congress, to the American people, and say what they've been doing for the last 5 years, what they've accomplished, how much they've spent, and then, of course, what their plans are for the next 5 years and what they would be proposing to spend for them. And we could conduct an audit on them, and yes, there may be some, I doubt very often, that would say, oh, congratulations, you've done a great job, keep it up, Charlie. But most of them would be duplicated, unnecessary, unwieldy, much too expensive, and it would be reduced enormously. Again, we have to reduce our government spending by 43%, and that means that we are going to reduce those agencies. Today, we almost have as many regulators in the Department of Agriculture as we do farmers. You know, it's absolutely out of control. And like you're saying, though, big government is really, really good at one thing, and that is increasing the size and the cost of big government. They're very jealous about that, and it just is continuing to go on. I heard a story, and while you were recounting your radio experience, I remember that back in the 50s, Nasser actually had someone come over from the United States to conduct an audit on his government in Egypt. And this man came back at the end of that saying, well, Mr. President, I mean, you just have so many people working for government that's just unnecessary and it's expensive. You're duplicating. You don't need to have those. And Nasser looked back at him and smiled and said, ah, you don't understand. As long as they're working for the government, they will be beholden to me. And that's what I want. They will support me. And that's where we are going, or that's where we've gone in the United States of America as well. We need to reduce the size, the intrusion, and the expense of government. And the libertarians stand for this. This is exactly what we will do in Washington when we get there.
Another tangent on this. You mentioned income tax. I believe that we should repeal all income tax, close the IRS. That would save about $15 billion. But also, why not just have a graduated sales tax based upon the type of item you're buying? So if you're very rich and you're buying a yacht, you will pay a greater sales tax because you can afford it. And if you're buying something at a dollar store, you would pay less because the likelihood is you could afford less. And so that gets one thing. And then at the same time, why not have a one tax without any deductions? So everyone has to pay at a corporate level, has to pay the same one. Otherwise, we end up as what we have now. In the state of California, Apple doesn't pay a lot of taxes because they are associated with Nevada, and then their money goes also to the Cayman Islands and to some offshore corporations. Why not just have, this is it. This is the amount you pay, a small tax. Make it very reasonable, but you can't get out of it. You can't deduct anything from it. A, that would save a massive amount of accounting and paperwork, and B, I estimate, and I've run this by Michael Hudson and many other economists, that we would be bringing in about a well over $1 trillion a year in extra income if we just had those. So we take care of the corporate profits, allow them to make a profit, they deserve it, but then they all pay. Because right now the biggest corporations, some of them are not paying anything, actually getting credits in return like General Electric did this last year. And on the other hand, a graduated sales tax. Your thought on that?
Well, Gary, we're in accord. And the one thing, before I answer your question directly, when Governor Johnson asked me to be his running mate as a libertarian for vice president, he told me, Jim, if your ideas are different than mine, don't hesitate to express them anyway, publicly or otherwise. What a man. You know, talk about no ego and self-confidence. So we all agree that we must abolish the income tax for all kinds of reasons. You were mentioning many. I was too. And the tax benefits for that would be substantial for the reasons that we were discussing. There are three groups, by the way, that oppose that. One is obviously the tax accountants, the tax attorneys, that sort of thing, and that's understandable. They vote to their economic self-interest. The other group is, of course, the people that work for the IRS and those folks, and that's understandable too. But Gary, I'm sure that you know who the third group is, the most powerful group of all, and that is the members of Congress. They don't want to give up the income tax because then they would be losing their power by voting for special tax breaks for their wealthy constituents, because then, of course, they get contributions in return. So we're going to have to go over the heads of Congress to the American people. What we go to thereafter, you know, it is a complicated area. I would have a consumption tax, probably for the poor. We would have actually a rebate of something in the order of $200 a month per person. So if you're going to spend $1,000, you'd end up with no tax. If you pay less than that, you'd actually make money, even if there were an 18 to 20% tax. But we'll have to compare notes, put our heads together, because it's a serious issue, and we will take all of those various things into consideration. But the thing that we all agree upon is we must repeal the income tax, repeal the 16th Amendment, because we certainly don't want Congress to end up with a consumption tax and an income tax. That's the last thing we want. So we will put our heads together and come up with something workable, some form of smart tax, basically along the lines that you suggested.
I'm a small business person. Yes, I am a journalist and an educator, but also I'm only able to afford to produce my documentaries and other work and social issue causes because I don't take money from anyone, no foundations or anyone else. I do it out of my own pocket. But it means that I had to learn how to be a successful small business person in a major city like New York on Broadway. No easy task. In fact, this afternoon, Saul Zabar, who owns the famous Zabars at 81st and Broadway, one of the most successful business people in America. He started with his family. He's 84 years old. We were walking up Broadway, and he said, "You know, Gary, I used to know every single person's name because every single block had anywhere from 4 to 8 different businesses." And he said, "Today, look at this. This is just another bank and another bank and or Duane Reade and another bank." And he said, "There are only a couple of us left. There's a health food store. The only privately owned Whole Foods in America is at 89th and Broadway, and that's my store, and his down there. And I've said this 1,000 times. We're not looking after the small business person." Now, why do I say this? And why is this in a very important context? Because you add up the number of people that work for small business people, how much they're paid, the quality of their work environment, the benefits they get in that environment, and you'll see that we have literally eviscerated the core of our jobs in this country. And I want to see those jobs come back. So here's what I'm asking you to explore in depth. One, if we can give $16.3 trillion in 0.25, which is zero interest, to 22,000 transactions, including $3 trillion to Bank of America, $2.4 trillion to Citigroup, plus Goldman Sachs, and all these others got money that was in secret. We have Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders to thank because they provided a provision that we would at least know who got what. But they wouldn't tell what they got for collateral, which was junk. So they end up with a legal form of money laundering. They took toxic debt, and that became their collateral to get all this money. In any case, that provided no new jobs. It went to the financial sector so they could continue dealing in derivatives, which we'll get to in a few moments, and buying up other competition and laughing at the American public. Not a dollar, not one penny went to opening up small businesses. So, my idea was simple. If you took the same interest-free loans, but now from the Treasury, because the Treasury could issue interest-free payments, and that would save us $540 billion this year alone, and you gave certain criteria. If you take $1 million for every $1 million you borrow, and you pay us back starting in 2 years, so you have a chance to get on your feet. And if you hire one employee for every $1 million that we give you at a living wage with living benefits, and you keep it in the economy, meaning you can't be then dealing with China or someone else. You have to make something, create something, and sell something made in the USA. My estimations, and I ran this by economists, we could gain 5.5 million gainfully employed people within 3 years. Now, if we're going to give some money at no interest, why not give it to American business people in cities that are now rust belts and ghettos to revitalize our economy instead of the Federal Reserve giving it? And I would get rid of the Federal Reserve and bring that power over to the Treasury, which we had it historically. Your thoughts on each of those issues?
Well, Gary, you're certainly on to something here. What has happened with regard to the wholesale spending of our tax money in the last 4 years or even 12 years is just absolutely outrageous, just simply outrageous. And you're also right, in my view, small business is the backbone of America. That's where the jobs are generated. That's where we make our prosperity. I wouldn't go so far. I wouldn't be giving any federal money to banks or to anyone else. I think that if you get the government out of the way and you allow small business loans to be made without undue regulation, which is where we are right now, that small businesses will come in, and that's where our prosperity lies. I was just recently talking with a branch manager of a local bank, and she said, you know something, I don't want your money now because it costs me money. I have to pay you interest, and I can't loan it out. And then she went on to say something that is shocking. 30% of my employees, she says, actually do nothing but attempt to comply with government regulations. So if we can just get the reasonable regulation, of course, have the banks responsible for any risks that they take, so they'll make good loans. They will make good loans to people with good business plans and good credit risks, and they can start those small businesses and hire 5 people and 10 people and 15. That's where our fiscal recovery lies. So we are absolutely nuts by having donated all of that money to the various banks and these various companies. It's simply wrong. I wouldn't have the federal government giving out anything to anybody, honestly. And as far as the Fed is concerned, you know, this is critically important. We will bring that in an evolution. We will bring the Fed to a close. And we're not going to do it overnight because that would scare people, and that's a part of our economy as well. But we have people already that we have spoken to on how to reduce the Fed slowly, such that over 4, 5, 6 years, we will have the Fed gone, which is exactly where it should be.
Okay, good. There's one last financial question that I have for you, and it's important. Most people are simply not aware of that, and that is the derivative problems and the corporate debt problems. Most people are completely unfamiliar with the fact that corporations issue bonds, and now that debt, that corporate debt, is maturing, and it's a tsunami. According to Standard & Poor's, the companies, mainly in the United States, but also in Europe and Asian economies, require a combination of new rollover financing and new money in order to have any growth over the next 4 years. And that's going to be about $45 trillion. So the wall of maturing debt is the largest in history. And yet you haven't heard, I'll bet, anything in any of the major media about the maturing corporate debt, have you?
No, indeed. And that is a very, very critical issue. We need to bring financial responsibility back to our market, to our government, to our people. You know, households have to balance their budget, so why shouldn't the government? I was just saying earlier that 43 cents of every dollar the federal government spends is borrowed. No company could do that, but you're right about the derivatives. Those things are out there. And also, by the way, on that same subject, most cities in our country are bankrupt because they owe more in pension funds and entitlements to their workers than they will have money coming in. So all of these things, in any form of a problem area, and Governor Johnson understands this, and the Johnson-Gray administration will discuss this, you first of all have to understand that you have a problem. Fortunately, I think we're getting there, although with the derivatives, we're not there yet. But secondly, then, you have to explain the problem to the people, not to the politicians, because they obfuscate. They don't want people to understand. But we will explain these problems to the people so that everyone sees this is how much money we're bringing in, these are our obligations, now we have to do something. And I found on the court, when I was a trial court judge for 25 years, if you would make information available that was accurate, about 70% of your problems would go away in a lot of these things. So as long as the government makes, or we make honest information available to the people, then they will understand it, and they won't believe they're being played for suckers, and they will be a part of the resolution. And then that's the third part. You actually say, okay, we've got some problems here. We're going to have to share some pain for a little while. We've been living well. We've been living above our means, and now all of us at every level of society, certainly those in the business sector as well, are going to have to share some of these problems. We're going to have to get our house in order. Now, that's what the European Union has been telling to Greece, and they're rebelling to their detriment, in my opinion. But that's where we're going to, Gary. Just like you were saying, the United States of America is overextended. And if you look at the Roman Empire, they were never conquered from without. They fell from within because they were overextended. Same thing with the Ottoman Empire, same thing with the Soviet Empire, and guess where we are right now? This is a serious situation. And unfortunately, my generation has caused this. My children are going to have to pay it back, and they are at risk, and my grandchildren are bankrupt. So this is something that we can't wait another 4 years with the Republicans and Democrats going exactly. It won't matter if Mr. Romney is in or Mr. Obama is in. And one of the strongest things that we have as libertarians is we're not Republicans or Democrats. We don't care who gets the credit. We will search out good ideas. We will embrace them. And people then give all kinds of credit to anybody who helps us and gives those ideas forward. And today they are so polarized in Washington. We watch it with despair because it's all politics. It's all bipartisan, or it's all partisan, I mean. It's basically bipolar, and that's our problem. So, yes, the corporate debt is there. We're going to have to explain that as well. If companies fail, then they're going to fail, although they can go through a bankruptcy proceeding and get more streamlined. But we're going to have to take responsibility for ourselves at all levels of our society. We haven't done it, and we're going to have to do it now. Good. We are in the responsibility business.
I'd like two short answers, if you would, please, on each of these points. And this is my final economics question for you on our program today. When you look at Greece and you look at 180% debt to gross domestic product, and the gross domestic product is shriveling, and it's anywhere between 80% to 200%, depending upon the country throughout the world, even Germany is, even though it has a strong economy, is still 100%. But it has the power to continue manufacturing and selling goods and also in financing. But you think Germany is solvent? It is not. It just has a greater capacity to grow than the others. But here is the issue. In the United States, according to Professor Paul Wilmot, and he is a professor of applied mathematics at Oxford University, and then I back this up with research from the Bank of International Settlements, and then I back that up with Jeffrey Gundlach, the United States and right now in the world are now looking at $1,200 trillion in derivative positions. That means 20 times larger are these derivative positions than the entire world economy. So the top derivatives are just simply showing that we are bankrupt. So if anyone says this is not important, then understand that what they're holding in derivatives, bets, in effect, dwarfs the global economy. And people don't understand how it works. And the estimated notional value of the worldwide derivative market was at $600 trillion, but now it's over a quadrillion. Quadrillion! How in the world do you get to a quadrillion? But we're at a quadrillion, and American banks, the four leading American banks, are holding the most of that. That means that there's even a slight change in the markets, American banks would go broke. Then immediately, as they've had in the past, they will run over to the White House, and they'll meet with Timothy Geithner, and he'll get in hands with Ben Bernanke, and the Federal Reserve will then start, like Zimbabwe, printing massive amounts of money to bail them out because, quote, they're too big to fail. And we'll be told by all these talking heads, well, we can't let them go out of business. Yes, they held $450 trillion in derivative positions, but we can't let them fail. And then our currency would be devalued and just watered down to nothing. But even without that, currently, if you take unfunded entitlements, funded entitlements, if you take corporate debt and you add in the federal debt, state debt, local debt, personal debt, credit card debt, student loan debt, you're well over $160 trillion. And then combine that, or put that, for example, not 160 trillion. You're well over 320% gross domestic product, meaning we are the most indebted nation in the world, percentage of our gross domestic product. So we're telling the whole world that they should get their act together, and we are more in debt than China and Russia and India and Brazil and Spain and Greece and Italy combined. And yet, because we control the body politic and we control the military-industrial establishment, because we control the media, we are the ones who are not responsible. We only have about a $14 trillion gross domestic product. So we are way in beyond what anyone else is when we're up there close to $200 trillion in debt. Your thoughts on this and the derivatives are the driving force of what is just suicidal economic policy. Are you willing to ban trading in derivatives and credit default swaps, and what do you intend to do to tell the world and our economy and the corporations you can't play in this casino anymore because the American public gains nothing from it and is responsible for bailing you out if you fail? Your thoughts, please.
Well, Gary, these are extremely serious things. And you have outlined them very well. Even though what you have said is true, I am innately optimistic about the American people. If you get these government games out of the way, if you bring back our work ethic, if you bring back responsibility into our society, what we can do is that if we just face these various realities and stop this irresponsibility, and it's led by our government. I said that we are Greece, and we are. In many ways, of course, we're in much worse shape than Greece, and it will take us a lot more difficulty to get out of it. And what the government's trick is that it will just resort to inflation. And, you know, well, it just waters down the value of the dollar. And, of course, that is going to hurt enormously, mostly the elder, people on fixed income, pensions, et cetera. So these are things that the government's fully willing to do, but we are not. We are fiscally responsible. We believe in the American people. We believe in our work ethic. And, again, if we're in such a situation that it does call for some more aggressive measures. And the biggest one is to repeal the income tax and encourage people to save money instead of take out debt, encourage people to invest money. That's where we get the generation, the engine for our prosperity. And, of course, we need to make our products around the world again competitive. The American people, if they have a level playing field, and that's a trite phrase, but it's as good as any, if we have that level playing field, we can compete with anybody. But we can't do it today because of our system of taxation here, our system of regulations here, and we're just really suffocating ourselves because of government. And as Governor Gary Johnson, as a libertarian president, will be in that responsibility business. We will look at things critically.
Okay.
We will look at them for the benefit of our country, not
right.
The special interests, but the people as well. And I can go back quickly. The first time I ever heard of Governor Johnson was while he was a governor of New Mexico, and he came out publicly in 1999 against our nation's drug policy. He didn't have any constituents that pushed him into that. He conducted his audit. He saw what was happening isn't working, and he stood up and had the courage to say he was going to change it, and he did work toward that change. That's why I began my comments with regard to Rocky Anderson, because I know he has done the same thing when he was in Salt Lake City. people are courageous. People in government need to be courageous. We need to push the Republicans and Democrats out and bring in the third party folks that are not beholden to us, these special interests, who don't have that paralysis in Washington, so that we could get some leadership back. Gary, I don't know if you would say this too, but I don't know if five leaders in our country today, except Governor Gary Johnson. We just have to put people in those responsibilities to not only vote your conscience, but to vote to somebody who would actually work for us. And Governor Gary Johnson is the most qualified person to be president of the United States that I know of. And I'm proud, excited to be his running mate.
Okay, I'm going to ask you now, because I have the remaining questions to go through, to focus just on answering the questions, all right? We're fully aware now of your commitment to the libertarian cause, along with former governor of New Mexico, Gary Johnson. But here's where the questions get tough, all right? And I've thrown you the easy ones up to this point. Now we go into the fast motion.
Bring them on.
All right, but remember this, the harder the ball is thrown, the further it can be hit out of the park.
There you go.
All right, I'm concerned that our corporate culture has no interest in re-establishing a manufacturing and service base in the United States. Their money is made when they have their own unique concepts of getting the cheapest labor in the world. So if that's India or Bangladesh, they don't care. They don't care about keeping jobs in the United States. In fact, they don't want jobs in the United States because they don't want any protection for the employer. They don't want any living wage. They don't want any benefits. So they're outsourcing. The trouble is, when they've done that and they've eliminated 52,000 factories in the last 12 years, and we've outsourced about 28 million jobs or downsized 28 million jobs in the last 32 years, it's made it easy for China, India, other countries to manufacture something very cheaply and bring it back in. So now here's the average American. They go into a store and they say, well, here's a bicycle made in China for $75. Here's an American-made bike, all handmade, in Maine. It's $165. And which one am I going to buy? And hence the big box stores, because they wanted the cheap bike. Well, now we have the vast majority of our imports are for goods and services that used to be manufactured here. What would you do? Would you be willing to put any form of tariff, any form of opportunity to keep jobs in the United States, or to cause those that were made at cheap and exploited labor elsewhere to be at least penalized, to level the field so an American factory, American worker, could have a chance of having something made actually sold in the United States or other countries? Your thoughts?
Okay, the direct answer is no. I would not put in tariffs. We need to be able to compete in the world. Tariffs just don't work. You artificially insert yourself into the marketplace in that regard by throwing up artificial tariffs. That's why we lost our steel companies, because we protected them for so long, and then they got fat and they didn't have to change. So that doesn't work. Milton Friedman is my hero, and he said, and he's right, that never has a country raised itself up from poverty except by using the free market system. Now, you are certainly correct, Gary, in saying that corporations are not patriotic to our country or any other. They are in business to make profits, and that's for their shareholders, etc. And if they can get cheaper labor somewhere else, of course, there's a problem with that, too, because like in China, the quality control is not as good as the United States. But we need to be business friendly. We need to be able to set up a system that encourages businesses to be here and to have manufacture here and work here and provide services here. And we do not do that. We push them out from our country to other countries because we are so unfriendly, so regulatory heavy, so tax heavy and the rest. So if we get the government out of this and allow these corporations, because they're going to make their product somewhere, if they can do it here, they will, if we're more business friendly.
Okay,
so
well, hold on. I'm
going
to
just cut. Artificially, I would go back to the natural give and take.
I'm just going to need you so we can get. Okay, I'm going to just need you to go a little more briefly on these. Now, then, as a follow-up to that, how can you look at the last 35 years of in effect, neoliberalistic policies, globalized policies that have allowed countries, even encourage countries to use what amounts to slave labor. It's not helping the workers in those countries. Look at Foxconn that had hundreds of workers willing 2 weeks ago to jump off a roof and commit suicide so that we could have Apple or other companies have a cheaper product to make and more profit for Apple, even though it's the most profitable company in the United States. It has a value of over $100 billion. So where exactly in this policy that you're suggesting are we caring for the workers in other countries or their environmental consequences in other countries or anything that represents a benefit to the people in those other countries outside of just sheer profit-taking on the part of those in our country that outsource these jobs and in their countries that manufacture and exploit their own workers to give these jobs? Your thoughts, please.
Well, Gary, it's an imperfect world, as we all know. And if we put up barriers, trade barriers here, that's not going to help the workers in the rest of the world either. There's only so much that we can do to help the workers, the people of the rest of the world. We do have to focus upon our country. We do have to focus upon our workers. And if you have, I just mentioned Nike a little while ago. They use a lot of manufacturing in Indonesia. Yes, they are low labor, low wages for our standards, but for Indonesia, they're really quite good. So you can't cure everything at once. But we can use our government to try to stand up for human rights and the rest of that, but you just can't cure everything at once.
Okay, well, I look at the job Hillary Clinton and our administration has done in curing human rights abuses in China and in Saudi Arabia and in some of the other countries we do a lot of business with, and I would give her what's below an F. Well, we don't have anything below an F, but I would give her a failing mark. Anyhow, I have five more questions for you. And this is a very important question. Many of us who are independent and progressive realize that the second largest single expense that works against us is the military-industrial spy complex. And it now accounts for more than 1,000 bases worldwide, 761 official full bases in other countries. Why in the world, with all these military bases and all the money that it costs to keep someone in these bases, why would anyone want to have these bases? Would you and the libertarians start closing down these bases, or would you keep them in place? Would you cut back on the military-industrial complex, or would you keep, as the last two administrations, their budgets intact, even though through sleight of hand they say it will be a reduction, but it's not really an actual reduction. It's just less money going in, but it's still eating about $1.4 trillion a year on and off books, all together, when the actual defense of the United States, according to leading defense experts, is about $220 billion, or still twice what China and Russia spend. But we're spending more than the entire world combined twice over. Why can't we come to grips with this and say no and cut this down to the size and save $1 trillion a year? Your thoughts?
You're absolutely right. We're in total agreement there. I was in the Navy. I would certainly just to start answering the question, we're going to supply our troops with everything necessary. If we put them into harm's way, they will be equipped well. However, part of that 43% reduction in spending is the reduction of the footprint of the American military all around the world. There's something in the order of 192 countries around the world that the United Nations recognizes. And as you're saying, depending on how you define a base, we have somewhere between 700 and 1,000 bases in foreign countries, for heaven's sake. If they're necessary for our protection, fine. But otherwise, most of them aren't. How many? I don't know. Let's look into it. But certainly more than half, probably more than 80%. Let's close them and bring them home. I heard recently, in fact, I guess I read an article that was talking about this small German town near a U.S. Army base, and they were saying, oh my goodness, if you closed our base, we would lose 92% of our revenues. Well, you know, that's too bad, but we should bring them home if we're going to spend that revenue. We should spend it in Nebraska or Wyoming or South Carolina, not in Germany. I don't think Germany is in any likelihood going to be attacked by Austria in my lifetime. Japan is not going to be attacked by China. We should bring those people home and reduce that footprint enormously. Not our readiness, not our battle readiness. We need our military to protect us, but we do not need them to have them all the way around the world in all of these various places. It just makes people mad at us, too. It's really counterproductive.
Okay,
the
good
answer is we would bring them home.
Okay, my four questions to go. Right now, we are the most money spent in the world each year on a single program is our health care. This year, it will touch $3 trillion for the first time. It's growing at about 12.5% per year. I've analyzed it. I've read every word in it. And being in the healthcare field for a long time and an expert in preventative care and complementary care, I do not find anything in the Obamacare that would help, A, prevent any disease, and B, offer people freedom of choice in going about the therapeutic model they need to actually reverse disease without this costliness that is insane. You can actually spend, and I did the research, get a suite for a night in the Waldorf Astoria, arguably one of America's finest premier hotels, cheaper than you could have a regular New York City hospital laying in that bed at night with no food, no medical care, no drugs, and no physician assessment. You spend more in a hospital bed for a night. The type of money we're talking about is obscene, and most of it goes to the for-profit hospital corporations for the pharmaceutical industry that has helped write all the rules and laws, including the Medicare Act, and for the insurance industry. They will reap about $1 trillion a year out of that $3 trillion. What will you do to save money, get better health care for Americans, and bring back from freedom of choice issues that right now are simply being erased?
Oh, Gary, we are galloping in the wrong direction with the Obamacare thing. It's just absolutely the wrong way to go. What we need to do is bring back competition, just like you say, in the medical field that will reduce prices. When I was growing up in the 50s and middle 60s, it wasn't even a topic of conversation that you couldn't find reasonable health care for reasonable prices. We weren't closing emergency rooms. It wasn't even on our radar. But then the government starts getting in there, intruding with Medicare, with everything, and dictating exactly how much will be spent and who will do what. The answer is no. And basically now, I've written a book as well, a third book that you didn't mention, A Voter's Handbook, Effective Solutions to America's Problems. I have a chapter on health care. And basically, I would divide our world or our country into three people. Most of the people listening to our show right now would be in the first group that we can support ourselves. We can take care of ourselves. So allow us to use our money by some form of medical savings account, have catastrophic insurance coverage of, say, over $4,000 a year, and then if you didn't spend that much, and most people don't, you could roll it over to the next year for kind of like an IRA account. So then you go to a doctor. Today, a doctor will look at you and say, oh, you know, your elbow hurts. Well, maybe you should have an MRI. Well, of course, because I pay all this money to my insurance company. So if you were to ask your doctor, how much would the MRI cost? She'd look at you like you're crazy. I mean, nobody even knows. We need to get back to you as the consumer deciding how much you should spend. You give some form of a swipe card to your doctor who swipes it and takes money out of your account, and you negotiate that just like everything else. You become a partner once again in your own health. So that would take care of the first group. The second group, there's people that there are in our country that they just cannot take care of themselves. And there, just like when I was in that great socialistic industry called the United States Navy, we could have medical clinics, probably on low-bid contract, kind of like a Kaiser program, to actually pay money for hospitals, medicines, and nurses, doctors. And that way, they would actually have their medical needs met much, much less complicatedly than what we have today, and it would actually be more effective. And the third group are those in between. They could take care of themselves to some degree. Actually, what we would have them do if they wanted is go to the government clinics or hospitals and pay a higher percentage on a sliding scale. But that's where we should go. Bring competition back. The health care will come back. Doctors will yet again be able to earn a living, which they now cannot do. They're being forced out of the practice of medicine. And I'll end my comments by quoting P.J. O'Rourke, who said, you know, if you think health care is expensive now, wait till it's free. It's just out of control. Let's bring it back to the way it used to be with competition and get the government out of our health care.
Well, I might add a footnote. We now have the largest number of people over the age of 47 in American history. We have 90 million. That's 90 million, approximately one-fourth of the entire, actually a little more than a third and less than a fourth the entire population. And we are going to start seeing astronomical expenses because these people have dementia, Alzheimer's, all kinds of inflammatory diseases. And those of us who know how these are created and can reverse them or prevent them are given no attention. And yet the holistic medical doctor, holistic nurse, holistic dentist is helping, holistic chiropractor helping people. And yet the government and our healthcare system has denied the credibility of that model. And yet you could look at any one of 88,000 holistic clinicians and the about 30 million people they are working with, and you'll see a completely different model, less expensive by almost 70%, more efficient without defensive testing. Because everyone goes to a doctor today or hospital, you're going to be over-tested because of defensive medicine, because of the unnecessary litigation that goes on. I believe that we should have no-fault insurance for every hospital and doctor and nurse in the country, so that way you could not sue them. If you had a damage, fine. Then you're given a basic settlement based upon the reality of what you actually are suffering from and the mistake made in how it impairs your ability to make a living. But none of these stupid, gigantic lawsuits, and separately that would save at least $300 billion a year that we now spend in unnecessary medications, unnecessary testing. And then look at the model in India. Right now, today, you can get any procedure done in India at a beautiful resort, at a very good hospital with outstandingly qualified physicians, and for one-fifth of what you would pay in the United States. And yet we're not using that as a model. That's a model that we should think about. If not, allow our doors to be open. If you really want in competition, allow people from overseas who are qualified in their field to come in and compete and watch how quickly we change. So I thank you for your opinion on that. I have two questions left. And one is the safety of our food supply and the right to a healthy meal. Right now we have 18 million children who go to bed hungry each night in the United States. We have more obesity, more malnutrition. We have more people who cannot afford food. Now, I just got back off the road. I've been out there twice this year for a total of 24 weeks. Half of this last year, I've been traveling and filming for a new documentary called Poverty, Inc. And I'm not talking about where I came from in Appalachia or the dirt farms in Mississippi and Louisiana. I'm talking about people who never thought that they would have to be eating cat food because they couldn't afford regular tuna and are eating crackers, eating one meal a day. I'm filming that. I'm seeing that. You won't see it in New York City, in Manhattan, in Beverly Hills, but you start going the rest of America, and there is a rest of America, and suddenly you see it by the tens of millions. An estimated 100 million Americans are food challenged today. What would you do to help those individuals be able to obtain healthy food, and especially the children who are going hungry in the United States?
Well, and this is something that's just intolerable as well, Gary, and I know we kind of sweep a lot of those people off to the side and not in our administration. The thing, though, too, libertarians see things that we certainly need government. But government is the last resort instead of the first resort. We will take care of people, but only after the, first of all, if they can't take care of themselves, then you do have a lot of philanthropic organizations that are rallying. They won't do it if the government steps in, but we can do that. You're talking about the obesity issue. It's critically important that we get honest information out into society so people see what the calorie counts are and see what is made up within these various foods. And then people will start, you know, one hamburger place will start competing with another that we have less saturated fat than they do, so come to us. And that sort of thing works. But when it comes down to it, in a Johnson Gray administration, nobody is going to be going home hungry. You know, we are going to have our people cared for. Of course, once we get the economy back and bring back more prosperity, that will certainly help as well, and that we can get back to the other things we've talked about.
Okay, my last question for you, Judge Gray, is this. We've just witnessed the result of Citizens United decision in Wisconsin, the first proof that this Supreme Court decision, which Obama has refused to act upon, has eroded the democratic process dramatically in favor of privileged interests. Aside from the many state levels, such as Vermont, there's no attempt by either Democrats or Republicans in Washington to challenge Citizens United. What would you and the Libertarian Party do to challenge Citizens United so we can get that big money out of the election process, or would you allow the thing to go forward as is? Your thoughts?
Well, Gary, the Citizens United case was a travesty. I don't understand the reasoning. They say that a corporation can donate all this money because they it's like speech. Well, no. I mean, that's stupid. Corporations can't vote. There's a difference between an artificial entity and a human blood entity. So the whole idea that a shareholder or a corporation is going to be donating all this money, they should get the permission of each and every shareholder because it's their money that's being spent. And if the shareholders want to give the money, that's marvelous. Let the shareholder give the money. Corporations should not be giving any money to any of these causes at all. Neither should any other artificial entity, such as a labor union or any other form of group. And you're absolutely right. This recent election with Governor Walker back in Wisconsin, that was the reaction to Mr. Obama and what the Democrats have been doing and the Republicans and the Supreme Court with Citizens United. It's got to be turned over. Now, you know, if the United States Supreme Court says that this is constitutional law, which I deeply dispute, we're going to attack it from various ways and put in some common sense justices actually in the court, on the courts of appeal and the United States Supreme Court as well, that people that understand the way the world really operates. But this is something that simply must not be allowed to stand.
Well, I thank you for coming on and sharing your insights. I believe we have a much better view of what you and what Governor of New Mexico, former Governor of New Mexico, Gary Johnson, plan to do with your party, with the Libertarian Party. And people can go to the website lp.org, lplibertarianparty.org, lp.org. The book is Why Our Drug Wars Have Failed. That's the only one I was where I wasn't. Sorry, I wasn't where you had a newer book coming out or is out, and Wearing the Robe. That was the other one. One final suggestion for you, sir, just to think about. If you don't find any merit in it, throw it away. If you do, then you might want to talk about it with Governor Johnson. Many people, I believe, would be stronger in their interest in the libertarian principles if they cut off the bottom half of your of much of what has historically been perceived as libertarian and put humanistic, the best of libertarian with the best of humanistic, and then I think you would have far more people drawn to it, because we have more people suffering that if you left it purely to the charities, they're overwhelmed. I just delivered a truckload of organic brown rice this week to the Sacred Heart Church in Camden, New Jersey, to Reverend Dowd over there. And he didn't even know it was coming. I just knew that they had a lot of parishioners who were hungry. This is one man who doesn't get a nickel from the Archdiocese, and he does everything he can. And I was there about a year ago when I was filming him for my Poverty Inc. special. And he says, everybody comes here to film about Camden because we're the poorest city in the United States, and this is the poorest area, the poorest city in the United States. And I was even told by Mark Carr kept coming up and down the street saying, you got to get out of here, you got to get out of here. And I'm in the middle of the street filming, and I said, why? Are you kidding? They're going to A, they're going to steal your camera, and B, they'll probably kill you after they rob you. And I said, you think because people are poor that there are always going to be criminals? I said, I'm sure you have people who would result to criminal activity, but you have more people here who are just poor. And I said, so I'm not moving anywhere. And we had this whole conversation about my right to be in the street filming in Camden, and I didn't.
Absolutely.
I stayed in the street. And then I went to the Reverend, and I sat with him for hours, and he said, you know, Diane Sawyers came and filmed with us, but no one's ever come back with a nickel to help us. And while he was saying that, they had some dinners they were giving out, and the guy came in and says, we're out of food. And I and he said, well, how many are still left? It was about 600 people. So the next day, I sent over a whole truckload of food to help those people, at least for a short period of time. So I'm suggesting, this is merely a suggestion, that at some point, if there was more humanistic and spiritual consideration into that philosophy, you would probably double or triple the number of people interested in what you're doing, because I believe on the important issues, you're all in alignment. In fact, I've interviewed all of you, and on the hard-hitting issues, there's a lot of alignment. On some of these others that get all government out and let the free market prevail, I believe that may end up being a limitation for a lot of people. It's just a thought.
I understand, Gary, and thank you for doing what you're doing both on the air and off the air. But I would quickly add that you're not government, and you donated that rice because you are a philanthropic type of minded person. There are many there, but the government would be the last resort. And honestly, Thomas Jefferson, a hero in all of our lives, said, back when he was in with us, that we need to have a revolution every generation, because the private vested interests, special interests, will inveigle their way into power and will sap out the vitality and energy of our country. We are that revolution. It is finally going to be here. And in addition to LP.org, they can go to GaryJohnson2012.com, and that is our campaign website. Lots of information there, and I look forward to being on your show again and talking about these very important issues. Libertarians care. It's just that we're not the warm and fuzzy, oh, poor baby, the government's going to take care of you. We believe in private industry, the work ethic of making people work to better themselves. If they can't, then there will be a safety net. But the whole welfare, poor coddling everybody, just simply is a trap. It doesn't work, and what we do actually does work. So again, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you. You're a good fellow, and I appreciate the opportunity of sharing some thoughts with you.
All the best and success in your upcoming efforts. Judge James Jim Gray, vice presidential candidate, because the governor, a former governor of New Mexico, Gary Johnson, was out campaigning, so he filled in. I'm Gary Knoll. This is an extended version of the Progressive Radio Network when we're looking at hard-hitting issues, and I've set aside the entire evening to invite people such as Professor Harvey Wasserman, who's going to talk about the history of third-party candidacy, and Professor Jill Stein, who'll be our final panelist today, and Rocky Anderson, a former governor also, who is here to talk about the issues that we have to face. And I'm not limiting the discussion, and I'm directing different questions to them and additional questions based upon how they answer these. This is not a debate. I didn't see a debate was anything but chaos, but rather a chance for them to say what they're about and in a proper context. So hope that you're benefiting from this. At least you'll know a little bit more about what their policies would be on the hard-hitting issues. Let us now go over and say hello to my next panelist, Rocky Anderson, who we had on once before. How are you?
It's great to be with you, Gary. And I think you misspoke.
Oh, no,
you're
two-time ex-mayor.
Mayor.
I'm sorry, you
that's
are
right.
two-term mayor of Salt Lake City.
That's right. And I will likely never in this lifetime be governor of the state of Utah.
Good. That's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, I think you understand why. Although it's a beautiful state. It's outside of Salt Lake City. It's mostly a very, very conservative in the sense of attached to the status quo state. And that's why we definitely had our challenges, but I love being mayor, and the people of Salt Lake City are fantastic and mostly very progressive, and that means
good. Willing
to try changes and innovation. I know that's a lot of what we're going to be talking about.
That's all we're going to be talking about, and it's your turn up because you saw and listened in with my comments. And we're not asking people to comment on any of the other candidates' platforms, only their own, or the administration, or the current powers in Washington. This way you each have the same opportunity, because based upon how long this program is today, it would be impossible to be responding to what other people said. Just your own points of view, so that way it's all fair. We're all given the same opportunity. The website is justicepartyusa.net, justicepartyusa.net. My guest is Rocky Anderson. I welcome all of you from around the United States. We're video streaming. You can watch today's program by going to progressiveradionetwork.com. I'm going to take a little different approach because of what your party represents and what you are the spokesperson for that party. Let's take a look right now at what is happening in, or likely to happen, in Iran. You would think that we would have a media and concerned people within the media that would say, before we sponsor a pro-Israeli attack on Iran or justify it and rationalize it, as we did with Iraq, with weapons of mass destruction, shouldn't we stop for a moment and ask ourselves, is this warranted? Is this realistic? Is this in our national interest? What will come from this? And I do not see anyone, not even the talking heads on MSNBC or the or economic shows, saying, what's the likely outcome? I would like for you to talk now about what you would do concerning Iran and the alignment of Iran with China, India, Russia, Brazil, who would support Iran, and what we would do if Israel went ahead with or without our approval and attacked either before or after the election, and what it would do to us, what would happen to the price of oil and hence gasoline, what would happen to China, who holds almost $2 trillion of our debt, who could collapse our economy overnight if they flooded the market with that debt, and our posturing on this, where we're not having any intelligent, open, honest, or historically accurate discussion on what could be World War III. You think maybe World War III would be important enough to talk about? It isn't, evidently. Your thoughts. Take your time. The forum is yours.
Well, thanks, Gary. I think it is so absolutely crucial that we have informed dialogue, and instead of everybody just lining up behind what seems to be an official one-sided doctrine here. First of all, you would think that we would question those in our government who are trying to make the case, along with Israel, for the possibility of a military attack against Iran based on a claim that they're building up a nuclear weapons capability. We heard the same things about Iraq, and it turned out to be absolutely untrue. In fact, our corporate media, it was announced 12 days before our invasion of Iraq that the International Atomic Energy Agency had established that the documents upon which the Bush administration was relying for the claims that Iraq had tried to buy uranium from Niger were blatant forgeries. And yet you saw that almost nowhere in the media in this country. Certainly weren't hearing it on the news. It was amazing that the major premise for us invading and occupying a nation that posed no danger whatsoever to the United States, which is, by the way, the definition of a war of aggression, which has been illegal long before the Nuremberg tribunals and for which we prosecuted and convicted people at Nuremberg. So there is the question, first of all, are the factual underpinnings there? And then secondly, even if they are, does that justify acts of war against another nation? And then the third question has got to be, if that were your conclusion, where does that get us? So as to the second question, do we attack North Korea because they have nuclear weapons? Do we attack Pakistan because they have nuclear weapons? India? You know, the buildup of nuclear weapons
China,
in this
Russia?
World has, exactly. The buildup of nuclear weapons in this world is because of the United States' refusal to disarm. When Pakistan was building up its nuclear capacity, we sent a diplomat over to try to talk them out of it. He reported back, well, they won't back off because India won't back off. India won't back off because of China and Russia having nuclear weapons. China and Russia won't back off because of the United States. So, of course, there's nothing we can do about it. This is how it's happened in this world. And so, along with the challenges of the climate crisis, nuclear, not only non-proliferation, but the elimination of nuclear weapons is the greatest challenge, the most important challenge facing our planet.
Would you denuclearize the United States? Would you stop the $12 billion a year for new nuclear weapons on top of the thousands we already have and start closing down these facilities?
Yeah, and why we keep building more nuclear weapons when less than 300 would guarantee that the world could be wiped out.
Annihilation, 47
Absolutely.
Times over.
And that's assuming that nobody is going to counterattack.
Right.
So
okay, then
our domestic nuclear policy has been absolutely insane. But getting back to Iran, if we allowed an attack or if we participated in an attack, that would simply bolster the support of the people of Iran for their leadership. And as you know, anybody paying attention knows, there's not great popular support for leadership, political leadership in Iran. And the Iranian people, they stood in solidarity with the United States right after the attacks on this country on 9/11. Hundreds of thousands of people out at candlelight vigils, standing in solidarity in Tehran, a huge showing of the Iranian people. And likewise, there were candlelight vigils in this country after the last election in Iran, people showing solidarity for what they were going through following the last election. So we as the American people and Iranian people need to stand together in unity and let our leaders know we will absolutely not support military action against each other, support of military action by another nation.
But you know that our Congress has just signed a statement that if Israel either unilaterally attacks Iran before or after this election, is irrelevant, we are committed to defend them, and or NATO's committed to defend them, and we are NATO. So one way or the other, if there is a World War III, you can look for Iran to attack Saudi Arabia's oil fields. You can look for them to blow up the Straits of Hormuz. You can look for the price of oil to go to $300 a barrel and gas to go to $15 to $20 a gallon. You can imagine what that will do to the cost of food. If we think we have hyperinflation in food, you will have hyperinflation on steroids. That will cause all the people traveling in the United States and trucks and planes to be challenged completely. And right now, Netanyahu has 85% of the Knesset under his control. This is the first time he's had that. So we're right. Dealing in a perilous situation. All right, enough on that. You've given us your position. I appreciate that.
No, but let me add to that. It's not only those consequences, but our own intelligence folks have and diplomats have said at most it would delay the development of a nuclear weapons program in Iran, and it would probably spur them on to do it because they would see that without a nuclear weapon, their vulnerability in that part of the world if they're subject to attack by Israel or anybody else. So the whole thing spells disaster.
What are you going to do when you alienate more than 22 members of the Arab League? Other Arab countries are going to take well to Israel, no matter what treaties they have with the United States or building arrangements for the United States? Suddenly you're going to see the United States as the aggressor because they're supporting and enabling the disturbing state of Israel's psychology, and not the Israeli people, I might mention, is the Israeli people are universally opposed to a war with Iran, except for the small radical groups and who happen to be very
right.
powerful, no different than our neocons. Next question, it's in addition to that. Right now, the United States is completely, totally bankrupt. I will challenge anyone with the figure statistics I have to show me that we are not when it compares our gross domestic product to our debt. The fact that we can continue to print money or backstop other banking institutions or even other economies, including the European Central Bank, is a completely irrelevant issue. What is irrelevant is that one of the reasons we've been able to spend unconscionably large amounts of money without anything to back it up is because of China and Saudi Arabia and the United Emirates and Brazil and Japan. Japan, $800 billion they have taken of our T-bills. And so we're out there. The estimates range anywhere from $4 to $6 trillion. We'll never pay any of that back, and everyone knows that. But they wanted exceptional trading advantages to bring in cheap products made with exploited labor. So it is work for them. It's allowed economies to flare up to 12%, normally around 9%. But now that's all cooling around the world. They've overexploited natural resources. They've overgrown their economies too fast. They have not considered infrastructural adjustments. So now everything is slowing down, including China. But China has quietly, and you would think the people in Congress or the media would know this, but they're out of the loop. China has built 17 phantom cities, holding about 65 million living units, houses and apartments. These are very high-tech, beautiful cities, but they're in the center of China, virtually in like almost an alien planet compared to Shanghai or other Beijing. Those are empty. There's no one living there. One of my friends has been an economic advisor to many countries, and 2 years ago he told me that China and other countries are gorging on our T-bills by using them to buy land, resources for feeding their countries, rent leasing land, building factories. In other words, they're taking out the back door quietly, not in an obvious way, the T-bills, and getting redemptions in a way that helps them, because they all know that they're never getting a nickel back, not a nickel. So the amount of money you're told by the financial community that China's holding of ours, cut that by 60% right now, and you'd be more accurate. Now, well, here's the deal.
I don't agree with your promise, but go ahead.
Okay. The deal is that if we'd continue to build bases as a holdover from the Cold War around Russia using satellite countries like Poland and around China, in a gesture that's a thumb in the eye but will mean nothing militarily against China, but it's a provocation. On the one hand, we're asking him, give us billions of dollars per week. On the other, we're afraid of you militarily, so we're going to increase our fleet in the Pacific. We're going to have a whole other scare campaign that China's the next major enemy. We're going to reinvent the Cold War so the neocons and their major corporations and the industrial and military complex can profit from this. Where does that leave the American people in understanding how do we get out once and for all of this constant cycle of setting up countries once we have exploited them by having them bail us out and taking their products now to be the military threat of the future when there is no evidence that that's the case? Your thoughts?
Well, I think it has been provocative, this focus now on militarization in the Pacific. But I do disagree with your premise that they're not going to get paid back. They will be paid back. But the question is, how much are those dollars going to be worth once they're paid back? And I think that's China's great concern, is that we've ratcheted up our debt to the point where to start paying any of this down is going to be devastating in terms of the value of the dollar. The dollar's already gone down precipitously the past several years, and it looks like that's going to continue, especially when compared with the yuan. Your question about bases, I think that's relevant everywhere in the world.
You're going to close those bases?
Absolutely. Well, certainly all except those that are deemed independently, not letting Congress make the initial decisions, but having an independent determination as to what bases are absolutely essential for our nation's security. I was in the early 70s in Heidelberg, Germany, and went to the Army base there. even at that age, in that stage in my life, I was appalled to think of the U.S. tax dollars that went into creating what was essentially an American community that was all, they didn't seem to be melded into the local culture at all. It was indeed their own American community at taxpayer expense, and multiply that out by about 1,000 and you can see what we're doing around the world. And I think it's been self-perpetuating because of the strength of the military-industrial complex. President Eisenhower, when he first came up with the term, actually called it the military-industrial congressional complex, and I think that's probably more accurate.
Okay. I get your point here, and it's a valid point. I'm concerned that people are not looking at the idea that if we really are stupid and we invade Iran and then we continue to posture against China, all China has to do is say, redeem your dollars, and our dollar collapses, and it's no longer the reserve currency. And what will you do if the BRIC nations, who are already going in their own, trading in their own currencies, and the South American 23 United Economic Countries have excluded America and Canada from any discussion or any participation, now are trading in their own currencies? What in the next 2 to 3 years, or 4 years at the most, where the world will not have the dollar for the reserve currency, you realize that's going to cause anywhere from a 20 to 40% drop in the value of the dollar. What will you do then with our interest rates and to protect from hyperinflation?
Well, we're at about 0% now anyway in terms of the interest rate on the dollar. And the way the dollar's gone and the way that the value of China's currency has been manipulated by China, and that's certainly something that needs a lot of attention and a solution. But China, there's no question that when you're out on the limb to the tune of about $1 trillion lent by China to the United States because of our outrageous, irresponsible debt, we're very vulnerable. But we can pay that off. I mean, I think Paul Krugman has explained this beautifully, that it would be paid off, but I think the inflationary pressures could be fairly substantial. But look at our total debt right now of some $16 trillion and the interest burden that comes along with that. We're wasting as much paying off interest on the debt as it costs to finance about 12 departments of the federal government.
Which department? Let me extend that further then. All right, fair enough, and I agree with that. But where would you go? Would you close down the Federal Reserve? Would you allow the Treasury to print money and distribute it at interest-free so that we could pay debt without the $500 billion a year we now pay in interest, and mainly to banks that never took the money but got the benefit of a 0.2% interest and charged 3.1% interest back to the American public? That, to me, is one of the greatest scams in the history of economics, how a bank that invested nothing and had no risk ended up capitalizing because of the association they have with the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. Your thoughts, what would you do about that?
Well, and actually, they own the Federal Reserve lock, stock, and barrel, and control what goes on in the largest banks. And I think the Federal Reserve absolutely should be moved under the Treasury Department. Our elected officials ought to be overseeing what goes on. Congress, all they get is a report once a year from the head of the Federal Reserve, and that's it. There's no countervailing check on it,
no audit,
watchdog that's reporting, no audit. We will look back and wonder why in the world we let it get to that point. And then you have the federal government with the repeal under President Clinton of Glass-Steagall. And
would you reestablish
the Commodity
Futures Eagle?
Modernization Act, which was just unbelievable how they set the stage for this economic meltdown. And the folks that set this up continue to profit hand over fist while everybody else is suffering. And we're getting set up once again as long as there are any banks that are considered too big to fail.
Would you allow all banks that are too big to fail to go through structured bankruptcy, allow the shareholders to take the loss so the American people don't have to, and instead of bailing them out?
Oh, they have to be broken up. And, you know, this isn't just me or people on somewhere on the fringes saying this. The Dallas branch of the Federal Reserve just issued a report, and they're probably the most conservative or one of the most conservative branches of the Federal Reserve, just issued a report calling for the breaking up of the banks that are considered too big to fail, because otherwise, as we saw recently with Chase, they will continue to engage in these reckless bets with derivatives, and they're going to suffer these huge losses. And when they're large enough, they're going to expect that the government's going to bail them out, because if the government doesn't, as we heard is the excuse last time around, then it's going to have even worse impacts on our economy. And I do think we're headed toward a real depression. Without the bailouts, but we got set up through that, through both the repeal of Glass-Steagall and through the passage of the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. I mean, it's amazing how many people in this country understand that, under Clinton's administration, Congress passed this act that allowed things like these credit default swaps to be sold without anything backing them up. So you're a bank, I'm selling the credit default swaps, you pay me to insure you against loss for these derivative instruments that are filled to the gills with all these toxic mortgages that are never going to be paid off. I promise you that it'll be paid off, but I don't have anything to back up those promises. And the guy that came up with that scam ended up walking away with $280 million in his own pocket. Joseph Cassano. That's an amazing story.
But also, we have to be very realistic. No one has been held accountable for the Glass-Steagall Act. I believe it should be. We should reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act. I believe that we should have independent audit on the commodities exchange. I believe that we should go after all these Wall Street predators who've broken the law and have a new, completely new Securities and Exchange Commission that's not afraid of them. I believe we should go after the rating agencies that lied and gave AAA ratings that people then falsely believed was a good and safe investment. And also, I believe that we should ban trading in all commodities essential to life. I believe that we should have no one has the right to profit when they can manipulate a market and people then are commodifying food, water, and currencies and land. So poor people all over the world who have nothing in the world to do with the price of oil now may not be able to use oil because they can't afford it, because some rich people had the idea we can control the markets. So would you be willing, or are you at all interested in eliminating derivatives, credit default swaps, and trading in commodities essential to life?
Well, first of all, on the commodities, absolutely, that speculation has been devastating, and it goes far beyond our nation's borders. As to credit default swaps, if you're going to sell insurance, like any other insurance company, you have to be able to back up what you sold. If you're going to insure against somebody's buying mortgages, for instance, you've got to have those reserves. And anybody that says that government doesn't have a role in this doesn't understand how all of this works. And, you know, again, if we can talk about the fundamentals, government, it's like in our households. We have certain rules to keep things orderly and safe and secure. In our communities, in our neighborhoods, it's no different in government. But we've got to get to the point where those running government aren't selling out to the wealthiest, as they've been doing, and that's the only thing that can be behind the repeal of Glass-Steagall and passage of the Commodities Futures Modernization Act. These folks knew that they were going to make out like the bandits that they are, with this kind of legislation, and Congress went along with it because they knew where their bread was buttered. It's the corrupting influence of money, and it applies to both the Democrats and the Republicans equally. They're both feeding from that same trough of special interest money.
Okay.
And in this instance, it's had horrific consequences for the rest of us.
Well, let's just give an example. Goldman Sachs got bailed out from a credit default swap and a derivative position with AIG at $12 billion. Yet it never invested $12 billion. It never lost $12 billion. It made out like a bandit. I think it was 60-1. And yet the Treasury Secretary and the head of the Federal Reserve both agreed they should get 100 cents on the dollar. Whose interests were they serving? And right now, we have lost the whole concept of what a bank should be. Are you willing to challenge the position that some banks are giving money at 40 and 60 times a reserve? Why not change the fractionalized reserve system so it's maybe 8-1? If you have to have $1 of actual currency to back up the loans you're giving, and if you don't, then you can't give it beyond that. And right now, the credit, many of the equity partnerships and the hedge funds have been borrowing money, $40, $50. They were gambling against $1 invested, and when they lost, the Federal Reserve came in and bailed out hedge funds and equity partnerships, because I looked at the list of the companies that got the 22,000 different transactions, $16.3 trillion, and it was hedge funds and equity partnerships. And that grossly offended me, because I'm aware, as many other people in the business world are aware, that had we let all of them go out of business in a structured way, it would not have dropped America off the cliff, as we were told. We were lied to because people were ignorant of the fact that the Wall Street economy is the Wall Street economy. It is not the world economy or the American economy, and yet we made it all intertwined as if we don't protect the banks, we lose. And that was a lie. And I challenge anyone with a brain to show me where, by going through structured, reversing all credit default swap positions, reversing all derivative positions, you take all the money off the table, and then you say, now, you got problems? Fine. Like any other corporation, go through structured bankruptcy. Would you be willing to be that assertive in the future of not giving a nickel to any of these companies, and if they get into trouble, not allowing any of them out? And would you be willing to bring back the Glass-Steagall Act and to stop the casino gambling?
Well, as to Glass-Steagall, absolutely. We need to restore that prohibition against common ownership of commercial banks, investment banks, and insurance companies. And it was Alan Greenspan that helped lead toward that, paved the way. Clinton went along with it. It absolutely set us up. I think the important thing is, Gary, is not to wait until the disaster happens and then say, well, we're not going to bail you out. You don't let the disaster happen by setting up the circumstances that have allowed that to happen. And the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, I know probably 99% of Americans don't know what that act is, but it basically said that there were no regulations, no reserve requirements. You can go ahead and sell the supposed insurance protection, and then when everything falls out and a company like AIG doesn't have anything to pay off those insurance promises, then the government is going to bail them out. And it wasn't just Goldman Sachs. And by the way, there are a lot of Goldman Sachs alumni who were responsible for seeing this all happen. And the revolving door, we talked about ways to protect, stop the revolving door between these firms and government regulators and those who are helping make policy, because it's so clear that this incestuous relationship, these people are just so self-serving, and it costs the American taxpayers, in the end, trillions and trillions of dollars. It wipes out pension plans. I mean, pension plans with the meltdown lost about a third of their value because of all of this. And so you don't allow these circumstances to happen and then after the fact say, well, we're not going to bail you out. Because, Gary, we can argue about what the consequences would have been, but I think you've got to admit it would have been devastating. It was devastating the economy, and it would have been more devastating if all of these banks had gone down in 2008.
You and I, sir, Rocky, will have a difference of opinion. I have looked at this very carefully, methodically, and because we assume that one economy is the total economy, we have eight economies, each separate and each unique to the individuals, and those banks don't touch at all on six of the other eight economies. The money made on Wall Street last year, with 14% showing improvement in our economy, was from the financial sector, but that they didn't open up new factories, they didn't loan to small businesses, they didn't help people, and that was for their own. They made money off money. They didn't make money by building anything, so I believe that we could have survived, though the banking system would have taken a hit and those mercenary people involved in it would have taken a hit. Now look where we're back. We're back where they borrowed $16 trillion in addition to the other two quantitative easing money. They were able to take all their bad debt and throw it under the public bus at the Federal Reserve and have it cleaned and sanitized. And we didn't get a thing. So I would share a difference of opinion, but that's fine.
I think the important thing is, and this is where I think we have agreement, is don't allow those conditions to be in place that will allow that ever to happen again.
I absolutely agree.
We're not going to be in the position of having to try to clean up or guess what would happen if we didn't clean up.
Then if that's the case, I'm going to ask you for I'm going to go through a whole lot of quick issues and ask you for short answers now, okay?
All right.
Would you be willing to get all financing, not immediately, but get all financing out of all elections so we only have public-funded elections so anybody could run for office without having to rely upon the current system?
Absolutely. And if it takes a constitutional amendment to get rid of Citizens United, so be it.
That was my second question, so you answered two questions simultaneously.
Well, good. But we have to keep in mind, corruption in our electoral system didn't start with Citizens United. It's been corrupt
for decades,
and public financing is the single best thing that could be done, as well as free and equal time on the public's airwaves.
Great. Would you be willing, as a principle in all this, to close down the military-industrial complex to what we only need, which is approximately $250 billion instead of the $1.4 trillion, and separate to that, would you be willing to come to grips with America's loss of rights, including repealing the Patriot Act, the National Defense Authorization Act, and 17 other acts that have been put into place since 2001 simply to benefit the people who are smart enough to figure out how to get the money by keeping people feeling threatened, and that is the cyber industrial complex.
We have got to end the stranglehold of the military industrial complex, no question about it. We were warned well by President Eisenhower. It's just continued to get worse, and I would recommend to anybody, read the American Way of War and watch the film Why We Fight. It's incredible how we, the American taxpayers, have allowed those in Congress to make political hay by coming back and bragging about the pork that they were able to bring back in tax dollars to their communities, to these defense contractors. And that's why, say, like under the F-22 program, the contractors made sure that they had contractors or subcontractors in 44 different states so they would have enough senators and representatives fighting to keep these antiquated programs. And as to the loss of civil liberties and human rights abuses, I don't think anybody over the years has been more outspoken about these outrages and the ratcheting up of the imperial presidency than I have.
Would you reestablish habeas corpus?
Of course.
Okay.
Well,
this president is not
American.
Okay.
Well, of course he's not. And, this president in 2009 was asking for the power to indefinitely detain people, including U.S. citizens, without charges, trial, legal assistance, or habeas corpus. The NDAA provision allowing that is probably the most subversive, un-American act ever in this nation's history, but I think the Patriot Act certainly is a close second, as was the Military Commissions Act.
Now I'm going to ratchet up the questions. to throw you some hardballs, as I did the previous guest. Are you willing to convene an international and national tribunal of independent jurists to look into the illegal acts of previous presidents, to hold them responsible in their administrations and their agents for crimes against humanity?
I actually, before I started running for president, drafted a demand for the restoration of the rule of law. And it was signed by hundreds, perhaps thousands of people, and it was submitted both to Eric Holder, President Obama, the United Nations, and the United Nations Committee Against Torture, demanding that they stand up, as required to do under the Convention Against Torture, and hold those responsible for torture accountable, because the rule of law absolutely demands it. And this isn't about political vindictiveness or partisanship or anything else. It's about standing by the rule of law and making certain that nobody is above the law.
Good, because if we're going to go after Bosnian Serbs and bring them to justice today, then, and they change the laws, all administrations around the world change the laws when they're committing acts that are against human rights, to protect them, to identify them. And I want to see that whatever laws they have passed, we repeal those laws and hold those people accountable, just as they did. Because when Obama came in, he was against secrecy and illegal wiretaps. But then when it was determined by the New York Times that was holding information for over a year and 2 months, that there was an illegal wiretapping campaign by all the internet companies, including Verizon, illegally wiretapping average Americans' home without due process, without warrants, then they turn around and pass a law that Obama supported and signed on to that then indemnified them. They went back and rewrote a law. I think that that is terrible.
It immunized them from the criminal prohibitions that were in place. And President Obama voted for that when he was in the United States Senate, after promising before he got the Democratic nomination that he would stand in opposition and join a filibuster against it. It was a sign of what was to come with President Obama in terms of his undermining the rule of law and his playing politics with these kinds of issues and reneging on his earlier promises.
Good. And that takes care of that. What would you do, or would you be willing to have an independent, completely independent of anything in government, an independent review of the events surrounding 9/11 that the scientists have said they have questions about, that individuals who we can now prove, including some of the leading scientists in the world, architectural engineers and others, that there were inconsistencies, contradictions, now and out fabrications in the official report of 9/11, to have a new, honest, open, objective, scientifically based review of the evidence and allow over 1,300 individuals who were witnesses to come forward, who were excluded after their preliminary testimony and the evidence they had, to come forth so we can finally know the truth of what happened.
I said yes.
I've called
for an independent investigation with full disclosure to the public ever since this became an issue. There's so many significant questions, and I'm not going to prejudge it. I don't know.
No, we shouldn't prejudge it.
The fact that none of us know means that we deserve the truth, and that calls for an independent investigation. You know, we used to have statesmen and stateswomen in Congress that believed in finding out the truth, and they didn't care if they were Republicans or Democrats. We saw the Church Committee, for instance, and a House committee, and also the Rockefeller Commission under President Ford. They saw that there were problems in the intelligence community, abuses of the violations of the law, and they said, we're going to get to the bottom of it. That's what you do in a democracy. And they did it, and it was a proud moment in this nation's history. Now we have a bunch of people from President Obama on down, almost everybody in Congress, saying, let's just sweep it all under the rug. We're not interested in letting the truth come out. And on this, it's too important. We all deserve the truth, and those who come after us deserve the truth. And if we let much more time pass, we're not likely to get to the truth.
Are you willing to consider or implement a Truth and Reconciliation Commission for those in government, past or present, who have committed either false flag treason or are aware of it, or who have participated or obstructed justice in some way to the detriment of the American public, so that anything that may have happened in any agency of government will now know that they will be protected as long as they tell us the truth? And we will not prosecute them. That's the whole point of a Truth and Reconciliation. It's worked in Argentina. It worked in Chile. It's worked in Brazil. And it's worked in South Africa. Would you be willing to do that in the United States?
Well, in those other countries, they were focused on certain episodes in their nation's history. It wasn't just like, come tell us anything that you have. And so long as it's not truly, and I don't even like using the word national security because it's been butchered so badly by people who have hidden behind that term to keep the truth from the American people, including with the State Secrets Act, which has knocked the courts out as a check in our system of government on abuses of power by the executive branch. But I think that we ought to protect whistleblowers if there's been illegal conduct, if there have been violations of the law, then they ought to be protected. And I think that what we're seeing now with the WikiLeaks disclosures and Bradley Manning, I mean, he brought to light a video film of innocent people, including Reuters journalists, being killed in the streets of Baghdad by American agents. And he's being prosecuted for that when there's no accountability for the murders. That's just absolutely wrong.
But at the same time, the New York Times interviews 22 individuals, current administration officials, supporting releasing secret information that supports Obama's position. Isn't it rather ironic that Bradley Manning, who committed no crime except the idea that somehow he was engaged in a form of sedition, is now capable of being killed or held indefinitely in prison, and yet he exposed a crime, and now the people are coming forward with the same secrecy being revealed, but that supports the president's election campaign, and they're not being held to the same standards of accountability for breaking the law. Isn't there some kind of contradiction here?
Of course there is. It's totally hypocritical. And here it's being done for political purposes. What Bradley Manning did was, I think, for the highest purposes. And I've got to disagree with your use of the word sedition. I don't think what he did was seditious.
No, I don't either. I'm just saying that they are calling it. In fact, people Bill O'Reilly suggested that he should be killed. On Fox News, the people were saying that he should be killed without even knowing the full facts. And that was disturbing, that a network would allow itself to have so-called experts on who are just really paid shills and flacks to go on rants. And they did the same thing leading up to the war in Iraq.
But you're talking about Fox, remember that?
Fox,
That's not at all surprising.
Yeah, where they pretend to be journalists and objective. I just have a few more issues here that are a concern to all of us. What would you do to help the 18 million hungry children? What would you do to help the 11 million homes that are nearing foreclosure, that are underwater? What would you do to help the people, 44 million Americans, who are homeless? You may not see them on the streets, but they're couch surfing. They're staying in incredibly challenging environments with mothers and fathers living with sons living with grandparents. You can't imagine what I've seen out there and filmed out there. What would you do to help these people who are suffering? And there's 240 million Americans currently suffering, and they're on no one's radar to be helped. They're not in the media's radar, and it's as if they should suffer in silence, and that includes 11 million and senior citizens who cannot now maintain any quality of life and are challenged at the poverty level.
Gary, as to those who are going hungry in this country, we are good enough and capable of providing substantial, sufficient food that's nutritious to those who are going without. We have school lunch programs. That was a good beginning for people who are economically disadvantaged. We can replicate those programs for families. We have food banks around the country, but, and I hate to say this because I love the concept of food banks, but I've delivered as a volunteer for a food bank, and the sugary water, sugary food, sugar-coated pastries, I couldn't believe that that's what we were delivering to people who were in need of good, nutritious food. So one of the real problems in this country is healthy food is expensive by comparison to what you find in many poor areas. And we've got to be able to provide healthy foods. A lot of that, it might require subsidies, but what better to help out people that are they're doomed to diabetes and other diseases with the kind of poor nutrition that they see in this country. I think nutrition has got to move way up on our nation's list of priorities.
Okay, good. I might mention, Rocky, that at some point you may want to entertain speaking with those of us who actually can save people 40% on their food bill and double the amount of quality nutrition, where the healthiest food is actually the least expensive food. It's just not food that Americans are aware of, like legumes and pulses and lentils and beans and grains. And the processing of food is what creates the expense, but it's been ghettoized. So I believe that a whole way of looking at re-examining food would make a difference. In fact, I'll send you my latest documentary, which we're just finishing in the next 2 days. We've been working on it for 2 years. I'll send it to you, called Food and Thought, so you'll have that. Now,
fantastic. And I do think public education plays an enormous role in all of this.
Yeah,
I eat very, very simply. I eat very inexpensively. But when you see all these fast food places and in poor urban areas, it breaks your heart because you know what the impacts are going to be long term in terms of diabetes and other nutrition-related diseases. And can I also say very quickly, because this is something that I feel so strongly about, that we as Americans don't have the freedom that we should have to pursue alternative medical treatments to the point where there are clinics in Mexico that are filled up with Americans because they're getting treatments that they find efficacious, that they find affordable, but they can't get them in this country because of the impact of the insurance companies and the medical and pharmaceutical industries that have kept them out.
And the state medical boards in all 50 states that the pharmaceutical industry controls by defining what is an acceptable medical protocol, any doctor going against it, including doctors that I personally helped get out of prison, like a Dr. Privatira. His only crime was fraud, but the fraud was determined that he was not using current medical practices in California, but 247 of his patients showed up saying, yeah, he gives us nutrition information. He's a medical doctor. He's not doing chemotherapy. But in California, if you didn't use chemotherapy, radiation, or surgery, then anything else was considered quackery or fraudulent. And yet the jury did not want to convict him, as it turned out, but had no choice based upon the instructions of the judge. And so he ended up in a chain gang in Southern California because, what, did he hurt patients? Not at all. He helped heal patients, but it wasn't according to the current standard. And that's the draconian laws that exist in the United States. Now, state by state, we've repealed some of those, but we still have an FDA that is refusing to acknowledge that nutrition has any role in preventing disease. And strange as that may seem, if you make a claim that cherries are good for anything, they will say you can't say that because it hasn't been proven in clinical trials as a drug. If you say that eating walnuts is good for your heart, they'll say, even though the scientific literature proves that, you can't say that. So would you challenge the FDA and take out the politics and the special interests so that the American public could have freedom of choice in their selection of food and nutrients and therapists?
Absolutely. As long as the truth's being told, Gary, people absolutely are entitled to that freedom. And I've been down to this clinic in Tijuana twice. I've had friends go down. I've heard firsthand the stories of healing of people with MS who, one woman blind in one eye, going blind in the other eye, has 20/20 vision now because of treatment that she got there that she wasn't able to obtain in the United States. That's just one of dozens of those kinds of stories.
I'm fully familiar with that.
Firsthand.
I've been down to Tijuana and filmed all over Mexico, but I've filmed all over the world therapies we don't have here because of our politics.
Yeah.
A few more questions.
And as to nutrition and subsidies, isn't it amazing that we subsidize high fructose corn syrup?
Yes.
But we don't subsidize organic farming or the farming of good, nutritious foods that could turn things around in terms of the public health.
That brings me to my next question. The food industry lobbied for several years to get a Senate food health care bill, Senate 510, which in effect will destroy all small and organic farming. Why? Because in the actual details, you have to have a certain grade seed cleansed in a certain way, graded in a certain way, and the equipment to do all this is far beyond. It's hundreds of thousands of dollars, up to $1 million to get the equipment. No small farmer is going to be able to afford that, and that was intentionally put in there so only the mega farmers and the genetic engineering farmers could afford to do this. Would you be willing to repeal this law that we're fighting now and challenge the control of the genetic engineering companies like Monsanto and Michael Taylor at the FDA, who came from Monsanto and the USDA, to get real good, independent agronomists and environmentalists and food and farming people in the USDA, and get independent scientists in the FDA instead of the stack boards they have?
Absolutely. And again, this is in large part a product of this revolving door between industry and the regulatory agencies. This is replicated throughout our government. I mean, to ban the growing of industrial hemp in this country, you know why that happened.
Yes.
It's corrupting influence of money, of Dow Chemical and the cotton producers. And so we're in this country without the ability to grow industrial hemp. We actually import it to turn hemp into food stuffs and
hemp oil
fabrics
has,
and hemp oil, so many other things.
And hemp itself is stronger than any other rope we create. Now, two last questions for you that I've saved for last. Are you willing to decriminalize the use of drugs, and are you willing to allow...
No, I'd legalize them.
You would legalize them?
Yes. We should end prohibition of drugs just like we ended prohibition.
Then are you
alcohol.
Willing to also pardon those people who are in prison for drug-related offenses like possession of marijuana? Would you allow them out of prison now?
Yes.
Good.
And I actually worked on a presidential pardon petition for a man from Utah here. It's probably the worst sentencing decision ever. And the judge, his hands were tied. He talked about how unjust and outrageous this was, that under Congress's minimum mandatory sentencing, he had to sentence this man who sold marijuana three times, and the informant said there was a gun there. 55 years he's serving in a federal penitentiary because of three marijuana sales. Nobody ever contended that he touched the gun, that he threatened anybody with the gun. It's simply that the informant, after the fact, after the three cells, finally said, oh yeah, there was also a gun there. And 55 years for this man in a federal penitentiary. So, and I did get a pardon for Corey Stringfellow the last day President Clinton was in office. It was for his first-time drug offense, and it saved him about a decade in a federal penitentiary. I think the pardon power of the president should be used in the proper cases, and President Obama has been, I've got to say, just a political coward when it's come to utilizing in a judicious way the presidential pardon.
Okay.
And when I say
good.
Judicious, I also include compassion.
I understand
that term.
My final question for you today. The current and previous White Houses have showed no sign of heeding climate change and global warming threats. They are pushing for new nuclear reactors, hydrofracking, which has expanded exponentially during Obama's term, but launched by Bush. Alberta tar sands pipeline is still in the works and can be expanded to New England as well. On the other hand, we have generals in the Pentagon declaring that climate change will be our largest security threat in the future. Yet there's no indication that the United States is preparing itself, as far as other nations like China or Germany and Scandinavian countries, with clean, greenhouse-free, gas-free alternative energy technologies. So, here's my final question. Are you willing to stop all the nuclear power plants and go towards renewable energies at the level that, for example, that Germany has now, which is a whole new generation, and 65% of their country is using them now? And are you willing to acknowledge global warming and be aggressive in bringing down carbon emissions, even if it means challenging corporate interests and special financial interests behind those corporations to get out of global warming denialism?
Gary, I've been fighting this battle for many years. When I was mayor, I committed to abide by the Kyoto protocols at the very least, and in fact, over 3 years in city operations, we reduced greenhouse gas emissions by 31%. I think climate change, as I said earlier, as well as getting rid of nuclear weapons, are the two most important global issues we're facing. Climate change is certainly the most urgent because the window of opportunity to do anything to prevent against the most catastrophic consequences is rapidly closing, and I think that it's an absolute dereliction of any duty, including the highest moral duties we owe to our children and later generations, to fail to do everything we can. And I would include not only the elimination of nuclear power plants, but a moratorium and then phasing out of any coal-burning power plants, because if we don't get rid of the burning of coal, we've lost this battle no matter what else we do.
Rocky Anderson, first I want to thank you for your openness, your straightforward answers. You've given us a great deal of insight into how you think and what your party, which is the JusticePartyUSA.net, has on your agenda. As I gave a final parting thought to my last guest, Judge James Jim Gray, and I suggested that he would have a lot more people wanting to come into the Libertarian Party if they took the bottom half of their party's agenda away and replaced it with a more spiritual and humanistic principles and keep the higher elements. And I said that for Ron Paul as well. Here is my suggestion for the Justice Party. I believe that you represent a great many ideals that many of us who are independent and progressive thinking would align with. My hope is that at some point during or after this campaign, that you then are able to sit down with Dennis Kucinich and Ralph Nader and Jill Stein and Governor Johnson and see how you can all work together on what you can agree upon for a unified party in the future. And I believe that together you will have so much power. And so many people, especially Ron Paul's 10 to 12 million young idealistic individuals, and you take all the people who are idealistic to your causes, and you start looking at how, yes, there are differences, and that's fine and that's healthy, but you have a lot more in common. All of you want to deal with the important issues. You all want to deal with getting rid of all the military bases. You want to deal with the Federal Reserve. On the big important issues, you're all in alignment. And other issues, you take separate approaches, and that's fine. But at some point in the near future, I hope that you all work together so that we have a sustainable future. And we're encouraging all of our listeners on the Progressive Radio Network to vote for a third-party candidate and not just the current two-party system. So hopefully, if that makes any sense to you or if that has meaning in your future, you'll consider that. We'll always offer you a forum here to share your points of view.
Well, thank you, Gary, and I totally agree with you. I've called for that kind of coalition building, and we can't keep fracturing the votes when we agree on so many of the fundamentals. And I urge any of your listeners to take a look at voterocky.org. We've got a lot of good substantive information there, and I think that you know, we might disagree on certain issues, but when it comes to the fundamentals and changing the course of this nation, and especially this imperial presidency and disregard for the rule of law and our warmongering and empire building, we can all come together and build not only a better nation, but a better world.
I wish you all the best in the coming election cycle and look forward to another conversation.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Rocky Anderson speaking from Salt Lake City, where he was a two-time mayor, and he is also a major voice in constitutional law and getting back to the rule of law and protecting the Constitution and our Bill of Rights. And he is deeply offended by the corporate Democratic Party for its evisceration of the Constitution and having it morphed into a poor alternative to the GOP. I'm Gary Nall. You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network. You're listening to an extended version of the Progressive Commentary Hour. The Progressive Commentary Hour was created so that very serious and important social issues could be addressed with the leading voices in the field and without interruption, no commercial interruption, and no limitation on how long it took. With the case of Dr. Andrew Wakefield, it was a 7.5-hour program. And on the war on drugs, it was 2.5 hours. And we're going to hit probably 4 hours on this one. We have two panelists left. One will be a shortened version because he's not running for office, but he's to give us a perspective, a historical perspective, on third parties and why we should start unifying all the third party candidates who agree on most of the issues together, and that is the case. And my final panelist will be Dr. Jill Stein of the Green Party. My panelist now is Professor Harvey Wasserman. He is a professor of history at Columbus State College and Capital University in Ohio. He is an investigative journalist and author, and he's been a national voice in the anti-war and anti-nuclear movements for 40 years. He is also a senior advisor for Greenpeace USA and the Nuclear Information and Resource Services. He's written many books, including George Bush versus the Superpower of Peace and Harvey Wasserman's History of the United States, with a foreword by Howard Zinn. And he also has a program on the Progressive Radio Network. Nice to have you with us today, Harvey.
Gary, great to be with you. And I've been listening in for an hour. It's been a really fascinating discussion.
Thank you. Harvey, I'm going to ask you just one question. I want you to take your time and roll it through for us. I'd like for you to talk about the history of third-party candidates, those that have been important, and those that have been important but maligned, like Ralph Nader. And Ralph Nader was mercilessly attacked by the left. They, to this day, they believe that had he not been in the race, Al Gore would have won, or in another case, that he caused John Kerry to lose. I would like for you to share your thoughts on Ralph Nader and what he contributed and why I believe that they are wrong. I don't know if you do, but I can pretty well assure you I voted for Ralph Nader twice. I would never have voted for either the two pro-war, pro-corporate Democrats. I saw no fundamental difference between them and George Bush. I would also like you to talk about Ross Perot and Pat Buchanan and others who have held forth historically, but give us a long historical review, bring it up to date. And then, as if you've been listening, and I don't think you've listened to the whole program, I'm asking each one that after this election cycle, join together. Let the Greens and all the other parties, Libertarian, let them come together and form a People's Party for the next election cycle, where Hillary Clinton will clearly be the front runner, and it'll just be more corporate entitlement, Democratic politics. And yet the independents now represent over 50% of American voters. You never hear that mentioned. All you hear is the Republican and Democrat from the two sides of the corporate America. So the forum is yours. Take us through the history of independent candidates and their parties.
Well, Gary, it's good you mentioned the term People's Party, because that was actually the most important third party in American history. It was the farmers' movement that came out after the Civil War, and these people were grassroots farmers, black and white, north and south, or mostly west and south, actually. Civil War veterans on both sides of the fence got sick of the corporations in the 1870s, 80s, and especially in the 1890s, and really were a major force. They expected to be become the second party to push out either the Democrats or the Republicans. They were tripped up in 1896 when William Jennings Bryan got the Democratic nomination and injected a lot of confusion. Out of that came also that time came also an equally important party, the Socialist Party. You know, we talk about socialism today, or the corporations, the corporate media talk about socialism as a fringe sort of idea, but in fact it was very much a mainstream idea in American politics from the 1890s on. We had the most important and powerful grassroots leader ever to arise in American politics was Eugene V. Debs from Terre Haute, Indiana, a truly great man, a great individual, human being, who ran for president 1900, 04, 08, 1912, and in 1920. He got almost a million votes that they counted. We know he got many, many more, running from a federal prison cell in Atlanta because he had opposed American entry into World War One and was pitched in jail by the great Democrat Woodrow Wilson, one of the most racist presidents we've ever had. And our current situation, as you've characterized so accurately, is we have two corporate parties that really represent the corporations and not the people. There's not much difference between them except for cosmetics. And third parties continue to be extremely important. Ralph Nader is one of the few truly great men in American politics. And, you know, he has and continues to have a great message, which is of extreme importance. And his role as a third party candidate was very important. And I was reminded today that he was actually arrested for merely attending a presidential debate, which shows you how afraid of third-party ideas the two corporate parties are. Now we have Jill Stein and others running on third-party platforms. It is very, very difficult for a third-party candidate in the United States to get a hearing because the two corporate parties really have it set up. It's a Tweedledee Tweedledum kind of situation. They play on very slight cosmetic differences between the two parties that give the illusion of democracy when, in fact, it's controlled by the corporations. And I think if ever there were an expression of the power of corporations, it's the Obama presidency. He has proven to be an empty corporate suit, despite all the brilliant marketing that was done to portray him as a grassroots candidate in 2008. And, Gary, the idea that Ralph Nader cost Al Gore the election in 2000 or John Kerry in 2004 is absurd. We know that both these elections were rigged, and neither Al Gore nor John Kerry said anything about the theft of these two elections. It had nothing to do with Ralph Nader at all, really. And I think Jesse Jackson said it best. You know, we can afford to lose an election, but we can't afford to lose our democracy. And that's what we've lost in the past few years. The last third-party candidate to make a real dent and actually to affect the outcome was Ross Perot, who you mentioned. He ran as a third-party candidate when George H.W. Bush was running for re-election against Bill Clinton, and got 19 million votes, not only because he was a multi-billionaire, but also he talked about the national debt. He talked about some issues, amazingly enough, and did take enough votes pretty crudely from the incumbent, George Bush the First, to give Bill Clinton the election. And there have been other third-party candidates of intellectual importance. Robert La Follette with the Progressive Party, even Teddy Roosevelt in 1912 with the Bull Moose Party. But the corporations so dominate the political scene now that they make third parties appear to be fringe, when in fact it's the third parties that really have the ideas. We listen to a Jill Stein, or a Gary Johnson or a Rocky Anderson. These are the people who are actually thinking and saying things that have meaning, as opposed to the Obamas and Mitt Romneys, who will be essentially indistinguishable, especially on the key area which you've discussed, which is war. These guys are supporting, or even Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts, who's, you know, viewed as a left liberal, supports the American military policies, the imperial policies, which are...
She's a corporate Democrat. She's not progressive.
Correct. So, you know, and you stand up next to Scott Brown, you know, you wonder, what are these elections all about? First of all, they're rigged, and second of all, you've got two parties that are indistinguishable. I mean, I've been, you know, by circumstance, living in Columbus, Ohio, I saw the 2004 election stolen right before our eyes. And we, my co-author Bob Fitrakis and I, were in the position of yelling and screaming about a stolen election, which was stolen from a guy who didn't seem to care and who wasn't really worth supporting anyway. And so here we are, you know, out here demanding election protection. It's in recent times, it's been the Republicans stealing them from the Democrats, and they could do it again very easily in 2012. But Obama isn't worth fighting for. And so it puts us in a dilemma. What we're really fighting for is to protect the integrity of elections towards that day when we will have real opposition candidates running, as did the populists, as did the socialists, and so many other third-party candidates through history. And by the way, Abraham Lincoln, in 1860, he was essentially, the Republican Party was a new party then. It did stand for something. It made a difference. And now we haven't really had a third party or an outsider party elected since Lincoln.
I believe, Harvey, that we should be looking to the next cycle. I believe what we should do now is look through and filter out those people who are just corporatists, no matter what moniker they use, liberal or conservative is irrelevant, and see who really is for authentic change and hold them accountable, as we did with these, our guests. We didn't allow them to spin. We asked them, and they had an opportunity to really lay out their points of view, and then realize that in the next cycle, you're going to have Hillary Clinton, and the only reason she was Secretary of State was because it filled in her resume that gave her the strength that she missed on the last time out. And she'll be running as a woman, so she'll get a lot of the college-educated women's votes. And instead of women looking to see what does she represent towards women, you know, how does she actually make your life better? Why don't you take a look at her husband's record? Because she was crucial in every decision he made. She was there with every single decision. But we're not that deep. We're not willing to do that kind of research. So I'm very concerned. So I'm saying, okay, get through this election cycle and get some votes and get some people paying attention, but then realize together you have strength. Separately, you don't. And I believe that when you look at the numbers, now in the last election cycle, the independents were down around 6% or less. Today it's 50%, the highest number of people in American history now call themselves independent and are not officially aligned with either Republicans or Democrats, which are bobbing between 19 to 21%. And then realize
right.
that we have forms we didn't have. Ralph Nader didn't have a form like the Progressive Radio Network. When I started the Progressive Radio Network, Harvey, 7.5 years ago, and thank goodness because it came because I no longer fit on at that time WBAI. I didn't fit because my audience was a progressive audience. It wasn't aligned political, ideologically with what was going on at the station or the foundation. And I started with nothing. And then I remember the very first time someone Googled progressive radio, it came up in the hundreds. And the first week I was on the air when I started the network, it was in the dozens. Well, this morning we Googled, and I ask anyone in the audience right now, Google conservative radio. And here we'll see Rush Limbaugh, number one, and Glenn Beck, and Sean Hannity, and Laura Ingraham, and Laura Schlesinger, and Mark Levin, and Michael Savage, and all these top names within the conservative radio. Then Google liberal radio, and you'll have, you know, all the top people within the liberal, Laura Flanders, and all the people out there within that, and Tom Hartman, and Amy Goodman. But we're number one in liberal radio. That was surprising. But then, and there are about 7 to 10 million separating, around 40 to 50 million conservative and 45 to 60 million liberal. All right? Now Google progressive radio. And we take the top spots in progressive radio. This morning it was 160 million.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, especially right. because the Green Power Wellness Show is on the network, and thank you for having me.
That's correct. And yeah. so we now, let me just finish. We now have a forum we didn't have. We have people who are disenfranchised because the old authentic conservative Republicans and the old authentic liberal Democrats no longer feel, and both have completely legitimate feelings and thoughts, they didn't have a place at the table any longer with the corporatizing, bastardizing, and homogenizing of the original principles. And now they felt left out. They no longer felt in alignment. Now they have a place where they're invited to the table. There's no denigration. The policies that we're advocating are human policies. They're moral policies, and people are aligning. So the next cycle, we're anticipating upwards of a billion hits or a billion hits. Just today, I think we had 5 million on just the Progressive Radio Network alone. Those are astronomical numbers. I mean, when you look at Pacific, it was 430,000 today. Most of their stations were tiny little figures, and you realize, well, they're all dying. CNN's dying. They lost a 500,000 almost a listener, viewers. MSNBC, Fox, and the rest are losing hundreds of thousands. We're gaining them. So the idea that the independent movement is disenfranchised, splattered all over the place, have no relevance, that's just not true. We will have a strong voice and strong platforms and strong leadership working together from different perspectives in the future, just not today. Today it's still individual groups, and that's fine. But look ahead 4 years from now, look ahead 5 years from now, and you will see that that is going to be the difference of what determines the future in the United States. I'm very optimistic about the independent movement in the United States. Your final thoughts on this?
Well, you're right. You're right in sync with the Occupy movement and with the movement for holistic wellness and the movement towards green energy with Solartopian wind and solar and tidal and geothermal. It's all happening simultaneously, and I'm just thrilled to have the Green Power Wellness Show on Progressive Radio. And you know, the history of the third parties does fit into this. You've got two real moribund, intellectually bankrupt, morally bankrupt war parties that are completely locked into the empire. And the empire is the key. You were talking about the potential invasion of Iran. If we can stop this invasion and start turning around the imperial presence overseas, then this country can turn around, and the Progressive Radio Network and all the other truly progressive organizations will be right in sync with it.
Harvey, thank you for coming on and giving us this historical perspective of third-party candidates. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Gary. Anytime.
And Harvey can be heard on the Progressive Radio Network. And just go to our website, and you can look at his bio and listen to any of his previous programs and listen to his upcoming programs. I'm Gary, and all for those of you who are listening, we are now going to our final panelist, who is Dr. Jill Stein. She is a board. Yeah, she is a medical physician, board certified in internal medicine. But let's take a little music break. We haven't taken one. We'll come back and conclude our final panelists. And then I'm going to open up for about 10 minutes our calls. If you wish to call in at that point and share your points of view on this four-hour special, you can call 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And we'll be back in a moment with Dr. Stein. I'm Gary Knoll. Welcome back. In this segment of our program, continuing with our discussions of independent thinking minds who have not been invited to the table to share their views on how we can make it a better world, different perspectives on addressing our current and pressing issues, we have Dr. Jill Stein. Jill Stein is a medical physician, board certified in internal medicine and a pioneer in advocating environmental health issues in Massachusetts, who is the 2012 presidential candidate for the Green Party. She's a magna cum laude from Harvard, received her doctorate from Harvard Medical School, and she's written books on toxic threats to child development and the links between human health, climate change, and green economic revitalization. Over the years, Dr. Stein has been active in Massachusetts campaigns to better protect women and children from toxic pollution that is contributing to learning disabilities and also fighting the coal industry and the burning of waste. She's on the National Board of Directors of the Organization of Physicians for Social Responsibility. She's won awards for her public health efforts in clean water policies and children's health. In 2003, she founded the Massachusetts Coalition for Healthy Communities to support local green economies and grassroots democracy in various health care agendas. She ran for the state seat in 2004 and again ran for Secretary of State in 2006, and she received the greatest number of votes of any Green candidate. Her website is jillstein.org, and then the Green Party site is gp.org. Nice to have you with us today.
It's great to be with you, Gary.
As each of our other panelists are discussing, Rocky Anderson and others, the idea that what if we had a Jill Stein sitting at the table, let's say with Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, discussing an issue. They're both coming from a corporatist point of view. They're very much believing in their own ideologies. They are ideologues. But that doesn't mean that they're on the side of what is best. And that's why we're advocating our audience, independent and progressive minds. And in this context, we're not talking about progressive as a political identity, but rather simply seeking truth to apply towards solving solutions in the most natural and effective way that benefit all people and the planet. It's that simple. So that said, I'm going to offer you some issues. Now, before, when you're on the program, and I ask you just answer yes or no, and we get to later what the issues were today, it's not about yes or no. It's about telling us how you would address these. Now, some of these we've already heard from Obama, President Obama, and from Mitt Romney. So take it to any length you want. There will be no limitation on your time permitted to explore each issue, all right?
Awesome. Wow.
Okay.
That's great.
Perhaps the single largest mistake that is repeatedly noted for contributing to the economic recession, in my opinion, was the removal of the Glass-Steagall Act. And now we are also witnessing the adverse effects of Clinton's signing of the Commodity Future Modernization Act just before he left office. What, in your view, have been the negatives or positives, if you believe in them, of both of these decisions, and what, in your opinion, would you suggest as a remedy?
Thank you. Yeah, these are really at the core of our economic meltdown and the creation of a phony economy of high finance, which came to a kind of a screeching crash in 2008, from which we have not recovered, and these problems have not been remedied, so we continue to teeter on the brink and may very well be in for another dive, and it could be, you know, as soon as a matter of weeks, given the very precarious condition of the European economy and the fact that our banks are and our financial institutions are very leveraged through derivatives in all the chaos in Europe. So these are problems that are not rocket science. They could readily be fixed. The two problems you mentioned, the repeal of Glass-Steagall and the signing of Commodity Futures Modernization Act, those were both very much the products of influence peddling in Washington. They were repealed because of the really chronic buildup of pressure from the financial services industries. And we saw how big they are with their, you know, being one of the biggest funders of both political campaigns in the last election. both Obama's and McCain's, which goes a long way to explain why these problems haven't been remedied, because the financial services industry is still ruling the day. So, you know, the Glass-Steagall Act, for those who aren't familiar with it, basically provided a separation between ordinary, everyday, you know, commercial banking and investment banking, which means gambling, basically. And it's fine for people to gamble, but they shouldn't gamble with taxpayer dollars insuring them. And that's what happened when Glass-Steagall was repealed. It allowed ordinary, everyday commercial banks, you know, the kind that would give out your home loan, to then undertake these risky bets that is part and parcel right now of the financial services industry. And they're all protected by your and my tax dollars, which is why, you know, we basically bailed them out when they failed. But they, you know, they continue to just run these risks as a matter of daily routines. So we need to bring back Glass-Steagall. And by the way, Glass-Steagall was passed after the Great Depression, because we've been through this before. That's why the separation was created, and it needs to be brought back. It should have been. It speaks volumes about both establishment parties that they have not seen fit to do that, and we continue to, you know, to teeter on the brink here. And we just saw, you know, a couple of weeks ago where J.P. Morgan Chase lost billions of dollars because this kind of reckless gambling goes on. You know, and same for Commodity Futures Modernization Act. These both of these acts of economic treachery, by the way, occurred under Bill Clinton. So, you know, it again speaks volumes about both political parties. It's not just the Republicans that have thrust us into this era of you know, of a Wall Street economy, which is very dangerous to ordinary people. This happened under Democrats, and it continues, you know, under the Bush administration and now under the Obama administration. So the Commodity Futures Modernization Act essentially allowed for derivatives and these credit default swaps to go unregulated. And that's very much what got us into the 2008 crisis and continues to put us, our economy, our tax dollars, our jobs, all the rest, very much at risk. This should be remedied. It can be. You know, we can basically reinstitute the Glass-Steagall, and we can regulate derivatives. It's not rocket science to do this. The problem, you know, is one of basically hijack of our democracy in Congress. There are further steps we can take as well. Of course, the Federal Reserve needs to be brought under public control. It is intended to be a public institution. It should not exist for the benefit of private banks who currently run the shots, call the shots and run the show. There is no transparency and no public accountability to the Fed. So that needs to change. In addition, the banks that are too big to fail need to be broken up so that they are no longer too big to be. So they will no longer be too big to fail and too big to jail. The Reagan administration found a way to bring to trial and actually imprison about 1,000 CEOs that allowed the SNL, the savings and loan scandal, to take place. That was a much smaller scandal than what happened in 2008 and the run-up to it. You know, so it's absolutely inexcusable that these banks continue to call the shots with impunity. The banks need to be broken up, and in their place, we should establish public banks, both at the national, the state, and the municipal level. Public banks run like the state bank in North Dakota. Yeah, exactly, which is a wonderful institution that's been extremely helpful to North Dakota, has helped them weather the storm. It provides a real rock of stability and ensures that ordinary businesses as well as municipalities in the state have the funds that they need to draw on to make the investments they need to make. So this is not rocket science. This is simply a matter of, you know, of asserting our democratic power as citizens. And as Alice Walker so famously said, the biggest way people give up power is by not knowing they have it to start with. And that is, you know, essentially what my campaign and the Green Party is all about, is refusing to be told any longer that we don't have the power and we don't have choice. We actually do have choice and we do have power. The key here is to just throw off that psychological, you know, manipulation which they impose on us with great fervor and sort of saturation propaganda on a daily basis. And
let's go on to the next issue.
Very good. Thank you.
That took 12 minutes.
You shouldn't have told me.
I know, I
shouldn't
have. That was my mistake. My bad.
let me impose a self-imposed time limit here.
All right. Because I've got so many issues.
5 minutes maximum.
Good. There's so many issues. This is a question that starts with a little elongated contextual explanation. We've been led to believe by both the corporate Democrats and corporate Republicans that we have one economy, and therefore to boost the economy we should give tax breaks to the rich and we should take away subsidies to the poor. And the Democrats say we should build through jobs through bureaucracies, and the Republicans say we should destroy these bureaucracies. I believe that both of these are supercilious and trivialize the true nature of understanding which bureaucracies work and at what level, and if they don't, how to correct them, and what jobs can be stimulated. Now, in that context, I don't see one economy. I'd like for you to address what many of us see about seven economies. The economy for the poor, which is over 80 million Americans. The economy for the working poor that are virtually denied any venue for representation in our society. That's about 70 million. Then you have your middle class, then you have your upper middle class, your professional class, your wealthy class, and your super wealthy class. So there is no one economy. I'd also like for you to address the idea that somehow Wall Street should always be saved. I did a detailed analysis of what would have happened had we actually allowed all of the major corporations, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, to gone through a structured bankruptcy, to have eliminated all the debt, but at the same time negated all credit default swap and derivative positions, because after all, they were uninvested. To put in a dollar and get $300 in return on a credit default swap, which you could have at one time, is absurd. And also, when they talk about growing the economy, they're only talking about growing the profits off Wall Street that does not have anything to do with building factories, creating jobs, stopping outsourcing of corporations to jobs overseas, but rather actually building factories and building companies and supporting small businesses in the United States. So there's two separate questions here. One is, what would you and your party do to stop the excesses of that insulated, powerful Wall Street for itself and no one else? Because it does not trickle down. I've done the analysis. And also, do you believe that you could deconstruct these large corporations instead of allowing $16.1 trillion Bernie Sanders and Ron Paul found when they did the analysis through Freedom of Information, that that's how much the Federal Reserve gave to banks, over $2 trillion to Citigroup and three to Bank of America, plus foreign banks and hedge funds. They gave all this money. They didn't give a nickel to small businesses. They didn't give a nickel to infrastructure repair and change. They gave nothing except to their insiders. Would you stop that? Would you turn the faucet off? Would you allow every major bank and Wall Street firm that is in trouble to actually go through a bankruptcy and not save a single one of them? Or would you do what everyone else continues to do, Obama and Romney, pour unlimited amounts of money through the Federal Reserve by a fiat currency to keep all these floating at the same time that Americans are dying of neglect economically? Your thoughts, please.
Sure, and can I refer you back to the last question?
Yes.
Because I think, we're on the same page here, and these solutions actually, overlap quite a bit in terms of, you know, Glass-Steagall, commodities, future modernization, et cetera. And the other things that I mentioned that need to be done to fix the economy, that really speaks to your present question about how do we stop the Wall Street economy and create a real one, which, you know, is the flip side of how do you deconstruct Wall Street. Because in order to have a real economy, yeah, we do have to deconstruct Wall Street. And, of course, we need banks. We need institutions that can make money and credit available. But we don't need the gigantic Wall Street banks. So we do downsize them. We break up the big banks. We create municipal banks. We rein in the Fed so that it actually serves the public interest, not the private banks. You know, this is not rocket science to do it. It really is a matter of asserting our power as voters to create an economy that actually works for us. Because as you point out, this Wall Street economy is not working for us. In the last couple decades, 20 years or so, the wealth of the 1% has tripled. Just the income of the 1% has tripled. The wealth has done more than that. But the income of the 1% has tripled, its annual share of the income, while median income is declining. And, you know, the wealth of the lower 60% is actually declining. So it's not working. Wall Street has grown to account for now 40% of all profits, of all corporate profits. So it is this humongous monster which mostly pushes papers and restructures finance. It does not actually do work, and it doesn't produce things. So I want to put one more solution on the table, and that's what we call the Green New Deal, which is an emergency plan to create 25 million jobs, a job for everyone who needs a job and everyone who needs a full-time job, and it creates jobs at the community level. So instead of having what you described as, you know, 7 or 8 different economies segregated by income, instead, we have local economies that serve the location where you are, that serve your communities. And what the Green New Deal would do is provide national funding to communities who then administer that funding and who decide what kind of jobs they need in order to be sustainable economically, socially, as well as ecologically. So the Green New Deal would fund jobs to create the traditionally green economy, that is clean energy, local, organic, agriculture, public transportation, including active transportation, as well as clean manufacturing. And it would also fund social jobs that make us socially sustainable, including teachers, 300,000 who've been laid off, nurses, social workers, after school, musicians, cultural artists, musicians who are really the glue that holds our communities together, after school, violence prevention, drug abuse rehabilitation and prevention programs, affordable housing construction, all that would fall under the purview of the Green New Deal. And instead of going down to the unemployment office to collect a check, one could go down to the employment office to get a job in a public service or a public works that would help jumpstart the economy. At the same time, it puts people back to work, doing work that actually builds our real communities and a real economy, not the phony economy of high finance, but the real economy that actually meets our needs at the community level. The model for this is the New Deal that got us out of the Great Depression. It's not rocket science. We know how to do it. And it would fund not only those public services and public works, but it would also jumpstart small businesses as well as worker cooperatives, because these are really the backbone of our economy.
Good. Now, this is rocket science, what I'm going to share with you, in the sense that it's extremely complicated. So complicated that not even people on Wall Street, I happen to know someone who was a vice president at Goldman Sachs, when I asked him to describe in detail the back-end financing of derivatives and credit default swaps, he gave me a generalization. He didn't know the details. Now, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, in a brain commentary, laid this out. I'm going to share Dr. Roberts' insights. I'm going to share my opinion on this and then ask you to deal with this, because I consider this one of the worst things possible in the United States of the world economy right now. I believe that we're going to start seeing this implode in Greece. I believe that those people will make hundreds of billions of dollars if Greece implodes and goes off the euro. The Greek people will suffer, but there are people betting against any recovery. But a little story first, just a little background. There are all types of things that have happened with enormous mistakes made in Washington, on Wall Street, in corporate offices. They're being held out of the public eye because we have untenable, non-sustainable economic policies. We've got a zero interest rate, and people say, well, isn't that good? And I say, no, that is not good, because that's what caused the housing bubble. You know, when you had people should not have had a home because they couldn't afford it, saying, oh, good. And then you could raise it, the bubble takes up, you flip it. Now, and then you have corrupt financial media. These people are not telling us the truth. And also, all the while, behind the scenes, we have debt. Are you aware that corporate debt, I'm only talking about major corporations, have between $24 and $30 trillion of corporate debt coming due in the next 6 months? It can only be paid or rolled over. You don't hear a word about that anywhere in the press, do you? Nowhere. We also have, well, we only know we have $1 trillion in student debt. We have approximately $1 trillion in credit card debt. No one talks about the mortgage debt, the state debt, the unfunded entitlements, the funded entitlements, the pure debt. And if you added all those together, you're well over $125 trillion. But here is the problem. You mentioned the Fed. The Fed's been through this experience once before. During World War II, the Federal Reserve kept interest rates low in order to aid the Treasury's war finance by minimizing the interest burden of the war debt. And the Fed kept the interest rates low by buying the debt issues. And the post-war inflation that resulted led to the Federal Reserve's Treasury Accord in 1951, in which agreement was reached that the Federal Reserve would cease monetizing the debt and permit interest rates to rise. Now, Federal Chairman Bernanke has spoken of an exit strategy and said that when inflation threatens, he can prevent the inflation by taking the money back out of the banking system. However, he can do that only by selling treasury bonds, which means interest rates will rise. The rise in interest rates would threaten the derivative structure, causing bond losses, and raise the cost of both private and public debt service. In other words, to prevent inflation from debt monetization would be to bring on more immediate problems than inflation. Rather than collapse the system, wouldn't the Fed be more likely to inflate the massive debts? Now, here's the gigantic problem no one is talking about. Right now, we have $230 trillion in derivative bets by U.S. banks that might bring on its own surprises. J.P. Morgan Chase has, as you just admitted, lost anywhere from the low of $2 billion, but it's more likely $5 billion. And how much more remains, we don't know. According to the controller of the currency, the five largest banks in the United States hold 95% of all derivatives. The five banks holding $226 trillion in derivative bets are very leveraged. For example, J.P. Morgan Chase, remember, we're told it's the bank of banks, it's the best-run bank in the world, Mr. Dimon couldn't do any wrong. Well, they have assets of $1.8 trillion. So just imagine, on one side of the ledger, you've got $1.8 trillion in assets, but they're holding $70 trillion in derivative bets. That's a ratio of 39 in derivative bets for every dollar of assets. And such a bank, would you want it to go bad on anything? Because it could, the whole house could tumble. Now, assets, of course, are not risk-based capital. According to the controller of currency, as of just this year, J.P. Morgan held $70 trillion derivatives, only $136 billion in risk-based capital. Meaning, in other words, the bank's derivative bets are 516 times larger than the capital that covers the bets. So it's almost, I cannot fathom how reckless and unstable the banking position is. Goldman Sachs, by the way, takes the cake. Goldman Sachs has $44 trillion in derivative bets. Do you know how much they actually have in cash to back up that derivative? Ready for this?
I have no idea. No.
$19 billion. That's
wow.
$19 billion that they put on the table
wow.
with the hope that if something goes wrong, they'll cash out at $44 trillion. Now, give that a human idea. The entire gross domestic product in the United States is only about $14 trillion. They have more money that they're betting on than three times currency. That's 2,295 times larger than the capital that covers them. So here's the idea for you. Knowing that we have enormous debt, knowing that they hold all these positions, knowing that these are untenable, what would you and the Green Party do to jump in there and stop the credit default swaps, stop the derivatives, and stop this nonsense from occurring?
Yeah, I mean, we need to put a halt to this fake, phony system of high finance, which is almost beyond comprehension, how it works and the trouble it's gotten us into. You know, I think we need to stop it, and we need to move very quickly to a real economy. We are looking at, you know, at a very dire and risky future, not only with the economy. You know, what you've described for the economy has its parallels with the climate, has its parallels with our health, with the incredibly precarious system of international relations. You know, we are sort of a whole composite right now of incredibly wild, risky, irrational systems.
But what would you do about it?
Compound each other.
What would you do? Would you ban credit default swaps and credit or derivatives, or not?
You know, that's a question I can't answer offhand, but I, you know, suffice it to say, they need to be regulated for starters, and my impression is that they're just not sound financial transactions.
They're suicidal. They're not just not sound, they're suicidal.
Yeah.
Do you remember when Goldman Sachs was given $12 billion on a credit default swap from AIG? We paid that, and they only put up pennies on that.
That's right.
They didn't lose $12 billion.
Yeah.
We
right.
gave them $12 billion.
That's right.
All right. And
I think, you know, that how I see my role here, I'm not a financial expert wizard, but you know, I see my role here as reining in this system and ensuring that it gets regulated or dismantled or whatever needs to happen under the power of the public interest. Because right now, the public interest, as you know, just doesn't even have a word in edgewise about what happens. Our financial regulations are basically the wish list of the lobbyists of Goldman
That's
Sachs
right.
and J.P. Morgan Chase. So that, you know, what I personally bring to the table here as an activist, as a mother, medical doctor, and citizen of the planet, you know, is to say that democracy rules the day. Thank you very much, big banks, but you represent about 0.00000% of the population, and you should have that much say in what happens here. Right now, they're running the store.
Okay, good. That answers us. Now, I'm going to give you a series of rapid-fire questions. If you could, try to give us the overview answer in a couple
okay.
minutes each one, all right? So
okay.
I'm going to go one after the other, so I want to get to as many as possible, please. We have over 1,000 bases, officially 761, but we know that there are more. And that's costing us tens of billions of dollars a year. Do you see that we need 761 official bases, 1,000 unofficial, and spending tens of billions of dollars a year, or what would you do to close down these military adventures and bases around the world?
I would bring the troops home and close the bases, period.
Good. Okay, let's go on. Great. One thing Republicans on the Hill have correct criticisms towards the ultimate failures that will ensue with Obamacare when it goes into effect. For example, just this year, Justice Samuel Alito determined that a typical healthy 27-year-old would be required to spend five times more than the average $900 annually for routine health care services. What would you do to provide quality health care, both preventatively and therapeutically, at a more reasonable cost than what we currently offer in the United States?
Answers. One, we need to move to a Medicare for all system, that is Medicare, where the overhead is 2% instead of the private, massively wasteful insurance system run by insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies where the overhead is more like 30%. So move to a Medicare for All system by lowering the eligibility age basically to the point of conception, essentially. So that is one part. The other part is that we need to create healthy communities so that instead of having a sick care system, which is what we have right now, we systematically make people sick through a sick food system, through pervasive pollution, and a sick transportation system. We are driving about, you know, easily 75% of the illnesses that are out there, the chronic disease. So by moving to a Green New Deal, which essentially puts people back to work, creating that infrastructure for health, which puts an end to the climate problem, makes wars for oil obsolete, and puts people back to work, we can establish this infrastructure for health, which essentially is health care from the get-go, which is where health care needs to start.
Okay, fine. Quick on this one. Right now, Monsanto has had more than 60 of its former employees take positions of power, including Michael Taylor at the FDA, overseeing health safety, and USDA, other people. What would you do to either continue allowing Monsanto and DuPont and other corporations to have enormous influence by political appointment and sponsoring genetically engineered food, which what Obama does and Mitt Romney would do? Would you continue to support genetically engineered food as the food of choice and these people having positions of power, or would you reverse that?
I would reverse that. On day one, I would instruct the EPA to actually protect the environment and human health. And that means putting a moratorium on GMOs until such time as they are proven safe for human health and the environment, which effectively cannot happen.
Good.
They cannot be proven safe.
Okay,
so a moratorium amounts to a ban.
All right. One of my most urgent concerns is that Americans have access to safe, healthy, affordable food. Right now we have a system in place in Washington that is populated by many executives, attorneys, and lobbyists who are pushing their ideas of what an American diet should be. What would you suggest would be a way of educating the American public about what they should be consuming if they knew the health consequences of what they're currently consuming?
Well, number one is to shut down the propaganda machine that begins goading people into extremely unhealthy diets. And, you know, we need to put limits on that pervasive brainwashing that is especially aimed at kids. Number two, yes, we do need to provide information to people, but we also need to make healthy food available and accessible as a matter of policy. And right now, the food subsidies are largely given to agribusiness to make cheap the commodities that make us sick
and
obese.
Then how about sponsoring legislation that would mandate de-ghettoizing food? In other words, putting farmers market and sustainable local markets in every community in the United States that otherwise has no access to affordable, healthy food.
That's right. And we would basically rewrite the farm bill so as to prioritize CSAs, family farms, local organic farming rather than agribusiness and create a whole institutional shift.
Well, in foreign policy, we're witnessing the BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and South Africa, especially China and Russia, undermining the Washington consensus. Just this week, four Latin American countries have declared that they are pulling out of the Organization of American Defense Treaty, and America's standing in the eyes of the rest of the world is absolutely dismal, for the most part, and that in one reason is why China is making so much headway in securing productive economic relations with other nations. Also, this saber-rattling, this idea that we should sponsor NATO alliance nations to circle Russia or to put satellite defense systems around Russia and Poland or Czechoslovakia. And also, we should do the same thing with China. What in the hell do you think is going to be the reaction if we ever have a real economic crisis and China's holding $1 trillion of our T-bills and we suddenly side with Israel in a preemptive strike against Iran, what do you think China's going to do to our economy when it decides that this isn't the way we're going to play this game? Tell us what you would do.
Well, we need to restructure our international relations fundamentally so that they are based on human rights and international law, not on the exercise of raw military power or the protection of fossil fuel sources or other essential resources or defending access to foreign markets. You know, this has been extremely destructive to our standing with other nations around the world and extremely destructive to our own economic security.
It's not will Israel attack Iran, it's just when. I believe within a month or two after the election, what would you do to prevent Israel from unilaterally, or with the support of NATO or the United States, NATO doesn't move without the United States, invading Israel and the subsequent consequences that would be devastating to the world if there is an attack against Iran?
Yeah, I mean, I think from the first day in office, we would put Israel and others on notice that we are no longer providing support, military and otherwise, to nations that are violating international law and human rights, which Israel is doing right now. So, you know, so if we began to actually put the weight of our foreign policy assistance and our military assistance behind a good ethical foreign policy, we would see things really begin to shift. And it's not only Israel that needs to be put on notice. You know, it's Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Egypt, for that matter, you know, to whom we are still providing enormous amounts of military aid as well as other kinds of aid. So that military aid, you know, needs to be tied to support for an agenda of human rights and international law. And that means not attacking Iraq.
Good.
Not attacking Iran.
All right, four issues in quick succession. Ready? We have 16 million hungry children each day in the United States. We have 55 million homeless people in the United States. This is a disgrace, in my personal opinion, for a so-called developed nation compared to other countries in the world. Now, at the same time, austerity measures are being enacted out of Washington, both by Democrats and Republicans and by state governments, such as a reduction of months to receive unemployment and cutbacks in food stamps and other services to enable families simply to get by, just to exist. If you were elected president, what would you do to help these suffering Americans?
Well, you know, we are cutting essential services while we are squandering trillions in wars, Wall Street bailouts, as you mentioned before, to the tune of $16 trillion, and tax breaks for the wealthy, including, all sorts, including, you know, the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy and much more, and just a general reduction of corporate taxes and taxes for the wealthy over the last many decades. So there is plenty of money. And when they say there's not enough money, they mean there's not enough money for you little people. There's plenty of money for their friends to do all kinds of nefarious things with it. So by bringing a public interest agenda to Washington, we would have no trouble whatsoever providing for our legitimate community needs.
Okay. Right now, unless a college student comes from a family among the 1%, there's a high probability that 55% of the BS students, BA students, will go without a job. They'll be burdened by compounding interest on their student loans the moment they graduate. Even with a master's or doctorate, there are millions, literally 8.4 million, high-end jobs that have been taken by special visas, American jobs from India and other places. I don't blame the Indians. They're coming to get work. But the American corporations are able to hire foreigners at half the price of an American who worked hard and through education and through tenure to get to that position. What would you do to help the student debt, to help get rid of the student debt, up 275% since 2003, and to help those who have gotten their advanced degrees know that they're not going to be cut out of a job by a student that is coming in on a special visa that corporate Americas have done quietly without a word mentioned, and therefore they're out not only a job, they're suddenly with $100,000 in student loans they can't repay.
Yeah, well, just to address the issue of student loans, you know, we managed to bail out the banks, and they were the ones who caused the crisis. It's the students, you know, who are in a fix now because the job market has basically collapsed, and they're stuck holding these loans. So if we found a way to bail out the banks to the tune of $16 trillion, they who caused it, we can bail out the students who've been the victims of those loans. In addition, we need to commit to providing public higher education tuition-free, on a tuition-free basis. We did that during the GI Bill, and for every dollar invested, $7 was returned to the public treasury through greater economic productivity. So this is an investment that it pays for us to make.
Good. I only have three more questions. The White House shows no signs of heeding climate change and global warming threats. They are pushing for more nuclear reactors. Mm-hmm. Hydrofracking has expanded exponentially during Obama's term, but launched by Bush. Alberta Tar and Sand Pipeline is still in the works and could be expanded throughout the United States, clear over to New England. On the other hand, we have generals in the Pentagon declaring that climate change will be our largest security threat in the future. There is no indication that the U.S. is preparing itself or us for any other consequence except to simply deny that global weather patterns and changing will have any impact on us. What will you do to address climate change and environmental issues immediately?
A Green New Deal, which is really the centerpiece of my campaign, is essentially a Manhattan Project level emergency mobilization, and it solves two emergencies at once. One is the unemployment emergency, and the other one is the climate emergency. So it puts people to work, as I described earlier, by making communities healthier, more just, and sustainable places. And it puts money, it's essentially a stimulus package, smaller than the president's 2009 stimulus package. It would put those federal dollars into the hands of communities to actually create jobs, which create the green economy that thereby puts a halt to climate change, drastically and quickly brings us down to carbon neutral, and which at the same time makes wars for oil obsolete. This is a win-win-win.
Two more questions. We've just witnessed the results of Citizens United decision in Wisconsin. The first proof that this Supreme Court decision, which Obama has refused to act upon, has eroded the democratic process dramatically in favor of privileged interest. Aside from the many state levels, such as Vermont, there is no attempt by either Democrats or Republicans in Washington to challenge Citizens United. What would you do to challenge Citizens United?
We need a constitutional amendment that clarifies that corporations are not people and money is not speech. There is a movement called Move to Amend, which is alive and well across the United States, and some legislatures have already supported it. Some municipalities have gone on record. It creates a public movement and public pressure to actually do that reform to get the Supreme Court out of the business of hijacking our democracy. That said, there is something very simple that the president can do on day one without having passed a constitutional amendment, let alone even a piece of legislation. That is, the president can instruct the Federal Communications Commission to actually open up the airwaves to use by the public. These are public airwaves. They should be open to the public. And the minute that happens, then candidates can raise all the money they want in all the backroom deals they want to make, but suddenly it's a level playing field because everybody has equal access to the media for legitimate candidates. And that is basically your end run around Citizens United that we could be doing right now.
Good. My final question is my most serious, in that I'm seeing the impact. I'm seeing it in people who are now fearful of speaking out, protesting, even communicating their private thoughts over the internet. And that is because many of us independent and progressive thinkers are witnessing and raising the alarm about the nation turning into an elaborate police state, relying upon surveillance technologies and data collection performed in secrecy. And while the Bush White House Patriots Act established the precedent for this, the Obama White House has expanded it in a more heinous ways. The National Defense Authorization Act, putting what they believe domestic challenges to be in indefinite detention without any constitutional rights. We have the Strategic Implementation Plan of 2011, enabling the federal security agencies to work local authorities to target anyone that they perceive as a threat, meaning environmentalists. The FBI is actually now getting a workbook that if you're an environmentalist or an animal rights person, like PETA, then you're going to be categorized like a terrorist. We also have the Communities Against Terrorism program, permitting FBI and the Department of Defense to enlist workers in 25 industries to actually spy on fellow workers. I thought the last time I heard about that was in Cuba, when I visited Cuba, and people said that they don't talk in the hallway. Don't lie. Well, see that woman there? That woman is the woman who monitors everything in the house. I had to go out. I actually had the former head of KGB in Cuba take me around the island to show me how almost every house had spying devices.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. You know, that's one of the things the leftists refuse to acknowledge, is how bad it was in that sense. But now we have American workers being encouraged to being enlisted by the FBI and Defense Department to spy on fellow workers. And then we have the spyware and home appliances, supported by the CIA's David Petraeus, to wire all new home devices for what it calls clandestine tradecraft. And then there's Obama's recent assassination list and a launch of 30,000 armed drones to fly over the United States. How in the world could you not consider this a concern? What would you do about it?
These are unconstitutional, and if I had the honor of serving in the Oval Office, I would declare them so, and go to court if need be to have them expunged. These violate our civil liberties, our rights to privacy, and our right to free speech and to public gatherings, and. I share your concerns here that this is the slippery slope into the police state, and in some ways we are already there with Homeland Security, aiding and abetting the brutal attacks on the Occupy movement, with the FBI spying on, as you say, environmental groups. Nelson Mandela himself, has been classified until fairly recently as a terrorist because he was part of the African National Congress. You know, this is the stuff of a police state, and for the president to have the ability to throw you in jail based on his own personal private reasons, which he need disclose to no one, this is the power of dictators, and these are unconstitutional, should be labeled as such, and should be rendered null and void.
I believe that Nelson Mandela won the Nobel Peace Prize, did he not?
I believe he did, indeed.
Kind of interesting conversation, two Nobel Peace Prize winners, President Obama challenging and not allowing Nelson Mandela be taken off the terrorist list. What an interesting conversation that would be. And if only Martin Luther King were witnessing his input. Dr. Jill Stein, we're out of time, but I hope that you've had a chance to express yourself as you and your party are going forward for all of us who are independent and no longer constricted and relying upon the ideologies of the corporate left or right. You represent a breath of fresh air, and we wish you all the best in your efforts.
Thank you so much, Gary, and I would say the same to you as a radio journalist. Really appreciate your integrity. Your example is much needed.
Thank you, and it's jillstein.org, or the Green Party site is gp.org. All the best.
Thank you so much, Gary. Take care.
I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment for final comments and your input. You can call us at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Your chance now to talk back. Well, we have had a very long program, 4 hours long, I hope you've enjoyed it. I will take some calls if they come in right now at 888-874-4888. We've had so much input. It's rare that you have a program this concentrated, but at least I believe if you listen to what they have to say, they're talking about an altogether new order of things, deconstructing the corporatocracy that we now have, stopping the neoliberal agenda, with the exception of Gary Johnson's group in the Libertarian Party. These people are saying, let's protect American jobs, let's support them, let's get out of the military-industrial complex, let's begin to help people who need financial help, protect their homes, forgive student loans, focus upon renewable energies, get out of the Federal Reserve, get rid of the income tax, and start having sales taxes in a graduated scale. So if you want a yacht, fine, it's your right. Want a jet, buy one, but pay a good sales tax on it. But if you're shopping in a dollar store, pay a very low tax on it. And so we're not overburdened. Support the small business people in this country. Get rid of all these draconian rules and regulations that are so unnecessary. We could probably get rid of 50% of all the laws we currently have and be a better country because of it. Get rid of the money and finance at every level in elections. Have open and fair elections where you can't buy yourself a governorship or a senatorial seat or a presidency. And broaden it out so we're really looking at the real needs of all people. That's what we've been talking about for, well, I'm just looking now, it's 4.5 hours. 4.5 hours is a long program. I'm asking my engineer, we don't have any calls, so we're going to wrap it up. It's been a long day, and I thank you for taking the time and the patience to listen in. And also remember, this coming Friday at 7 p.m., we will have over the Internet, over Progressive Radio Network, we will have the premiere, the world premiere of The War on Health. It will be a strong pushback and challenge to the corruption in the FDA, the taking away of our freedoms of choice, showing you how they ended up getting to where they are with all that power, corruption, and enforcement, and how the American public is so vulnerable and just a breath away of having no choices. They'll have nothing but genetically engineered food, no herbs, no supplements, no alternative medicine if they have their way. So we need to know the problem and address it. So you can watch free over the Internet this Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Tell people now. Get them involved. We're looking for a global effort to wake people up now. For those in New York, tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. I'll be in Westchester or Rockland County. But that is sold out. Don't try to get there. You won't find a seat. I think they have 500 seats and they're all taken. And I will be meeting with health groups throughout the United States this week. And then I'll be Friday night at the Ethical Culture Center. And then Saturday I will be at the Huntington Cinema Arts in Huntington, Long Island at 1 p.m. And that's it. Then it's up to the people to take the information that has taken me 3 years to produce, write, and direct, and to do something with it. My hope is, after meeting with nearly 1,000 healthcare professionals, all of whom are leaders in the field this week on Wednesday evening, that this will start to be disseminated to millions of people. My hope is that this video goes viral and that we then begin a call to action. But that's up now to everyone else. Have a nice evening, everyone. I'm Gary Noll.